The Friday, November 15th, Transportation Land Use Committee meeting to order. First item on our agenda is the Loudoun Water Overview. From my understanding, we have some folks from Loudoun Water here. If you want to come forward, we deeply appreciate you taking the time to come here and educate us. Please.
Well, good morning, and thanks for having us. I'm Mark Peterson. I'm the Executive Director of Stakeholder Relations for Loudoun Water, and I also asked Tom Lipinski, who's the manager of our planning programs, to come as well. This has been something that we've had some conversations and planned here for a couple months. I know the meeting had been originally we were going to do it in October, but I'll just start by talking a little bit about providing some of the context on what brought this up. Back in at the June Transportation Land Use Committee meeting, we had representatives from Loudoun Water were at the committee meeting and talking about some questions and different issues that had come about during the Government Reform Commission process. And at that meeting, Supervisor Delgadio had taken the opportunity to ask some questions related to our system and some projects in the Sterling area. And after that meeting, we had received some questions from him and responded. And I think that helped with those specific questions. But through some subsequent conversations, there had been some it brought up some questions around just how do we, with the scope of our system, how do we continue in a county that has the type of growth we've got going on? How are we looking forward and planning for the future, and at the same time making sure we are really taking care of the system that we have in the ground? And so I thought what we'd do today is just kind of step back and give a little bit of a broader perspective on answering some of those questions that might be helpful. And so in doing so, I thought to begin with, I'd just step back and talk a little bit, without going into much detail, about the history of Loudoun Water as an authority, when and how it was created, and then leading into some of the major programs that we have today in terms of striking that balance. And this is probably review for most everybody, but some of it may be new information. But Loudoun Water was essentially created by the Board of Supervisors in Loudoun County in 1959, and that came about because of the Dulles Airport being placed in Loudoun County. And at the time, there was necessary to create infrastructure to serve the airport. And that was both from water service, which historically we've received water from City of Fairfax Water Treatment Plant on the Goose Creek, and from Fairfax Water coming in from the eastern part from Fairfax County. And also wastewater service that was also set up for the Dulles Airport through a Potomac Interceptor pipe that then runs down to Blue Plains, which is the treatment plant down in the District of Columbia. And so at the time, I think there was a really visionary kind of understanding that the way to do this was to set up the authority to be able to stay focused on what this service provides for the residents of Loudoun County, and to prepare for the future. At the time, interestingly, the Loudoun County gave LCSA at the time an original loan of about $16,000, which was paid back within, I think, the first year of that, and really have never looked back since. So financially, we've been in a very good place, and I'll get into talking about those programs and just touching on that a little bit. One of the important connections with the county and our continual coordination is that, obviously, you know, the Board of Supervisors appoints our Board of Directors. And we follow, as an authority, we follow the county land use policies. And so essentially the county says where and how much in terms of our services as a utility. We provide the technical perspective of how best does that happen in those areas to serve. I will just give a little bit of an orientation. The one graphic we've got is our system map, which is up on the screen. There's also on the board over here. But you can see, in reference to the county, the system, the central system is the area that is in the suburban policy area and the transition policy area. In the eastern part of the county, the sort of yellow mustard color outlines that. Also shown on there, and it's a little hard to tell in some of the color schemes, but our communal systems, which is generally in the rural policy area, are in the kind of blue outlines in sort of the 15 corridor, the middle part of the county. Just wanted to give a graphic representation of what that looks like. And it really shows how, you know, the majority of our system, and in particular our central system, is where the large population is, and that is in the eastern part. And it's also important to note that the major feed, in particular for our water, for drinking water, and where the wastewater is going through the Potomac Interceptor, is through that oldest part of our system. I'll get into it a little bit later, but it's always important to remember that our system is set up and structured in a way. It's intertwined. It's not a compartmentalized system, and so the health of the entire system is always very important, particularly where those feeds are coming in from the east. Talk a little bit about our funding programs and our financial program. We are revenue neutral. That's the way we're set up. And we have roughly about $100 million operating budget on an annual basis. Our capital spending program this past year was also roughly about $100 million. Over the next few years, that's going to increase a little bit because of the new water supply program, building an intake in the Potomac River, replacing what we've been historically getting from the city of Fairfax. And so we have that continual need for the future in the western part of our system, and we're building a new treatment plant as well. We have a couple different sources for our funding. First, I'll talk a little bit. We have an availability charge. Availability charge is for any new kind of customer, residential, commercial, any type of customer that wants to be hooked up into our system. There's an availability charge, and that purchases capacity in our existing system. Now, those funds are generally set up, and those are meant to really help build our system for our future needs. It's a growth. A growth, building the growth kind of, or paying for growth type of setup. Our user rates are set up and are use a formula to calculate what the rates are for the users. Those are meant to cover the operating budget and to build up some of the reserves. We're actually right now working toward, by 2018, our goal is to have 50% our renew and replacement fund, 50% of our depreciated fixed assets. So we're well on our way to that. So the user rates, again, are meant to cover the operating budget and then build those reserves for those parts of the systems that are already built. So with that, I wanted to talk then, in getting to the last couple parts of this, a couple major programs and things that we do. We do, one of them, our planning programs, and we do a number of different things. We do financial planning. We as we're about to embark on and build our new treatment plant and have an intake in the Potomac, and become really in a whole new way a public health agency, because we're going to be in the drinking water business in a way we haven't been historically. watershed protection, that kind of thing. That's another part of our planning program that we're beginning to really build in a much more robust way. And demand management in terms of how we're, the use of our water. But I wanted to focus today in terms of our planning on our facilities master plan and our asset management. And first of all, we have a program, and for throughout our history, we've been looking at the system and developing a facilities master plan so that we understand the projections of where and how much and how this system is being built. That, again, is an intertwined system that always takes into account the parts of our system that have been already built, and the health of that part of it is a major component and criteria that we're looking at. So we're not only looking to the future at what we're building, but that water that we're receiving is coming through the parts of our system that have been built first, and the health of that is very important. So our facilities master planning really is focused on looking to the future and what we are building. We use growth projections. We use the county land use policies as guides to know the capacities, the extent, how big our system needs to be, how big pipes are in the ground. So there's a lot of good information that we can use. And our goal is really to be ready to serve. If there's opportunities for economic development, for development, our goal is that we're not the entity or the type of thing that anybody's waiting on. We want to be ready to serve. The other component of that is what I mentioned, our asset management. One of the national trends in the water and wastewater utility business is that aging infrastructure is becoming more and more serious issue in a lot of the older cities, big cities. We're fortunate not to have that as a real issue. The majority of our system has been built probably in the last 20 years, even though we're over 50 years old. However, we do have parts of our system that were built 50 years ago. So today, we have a number of programs and things in place with corrosion control measures, looking at resiliency and redundancy, annual inspection processes that we are out looking at these oldest parts of our system to be sure that we are keeping up and that those parts of our system that are critical for the entire network are not being let go. So we have a number of things that we're doing, including ongoing projects where we're lining existing sewer pipes, and we're incorporating new technology to be able to get updated data on a real-time basis for really monitoring this program. So I think, you know, again, the primary message of today in providing this overview and coming from some of the questions that have come up in the past is that it's just vital for our system that we are looking to the future, being ready to serve, making sure we're prepared, but at the same time being prepared financially and that we're not caught by surprise in terms of the system that we have in the ground.
So. Mark, thank you very much. That's an excellent presentation. We deeply appreciate it. I'm going to open it up in case any of our committee members have questions. Okay, Supervisor Delgadio.
My favorite topic, because all your stuff is old, and it's all in Algonquin and Sterling District in the Eastern Loudoun area, obviously. Thank you for answering the questions I asked back in July as part of this package. Chairman Volpe, thank you for your gracious indulgence of me in the July meeting, letting me ask all those questions. A lot of questions, so and a lot of answers. Thanks for the answers. You covered it today in your presentation. You covered it in your response. At the last paragraph of the lengthy response to my questions that I asked at the land use meeting back in July, it says you're going to have an inspection of the water tower in Sterling this fall. Now, this fall is, when was this? Is this fall now?
Yeah, I'll let Tom Mapinski answer that one.
Yeah, that inspection took place within the last month. It was already done, and the results of it were that the inside of the tank is in very good condition. There's some standard few areas that need some repair on the inside of the coating, but we're actually very satisfied with the condition of the tank.
Moving on from there, the big picture, of course, is, you know, had a lot of details about the essential system that operates the old systems, and you have outlined your plan essentially is to, since it's doing so well, relatively speaking, according to your written report and verbal, you're going to put the money in there for a reserve. So what's the actual timetable? Are we talking 10 years from now that you're going to replace the system? Is that really the impression I have? Or 20 years from now, or 25 years? What's the timetable? We deal in absolutes, you know, in terms of planning. You talk about 75 years instead of 50. Prior to July, we were, you know, lay terms. We were told 30 to 50 years is the range of the life of these pipes. Now, today, and in the record, we're being told 75 to 100 years is the record, is the standard. And you have use standards that you're watching and you're keeping an eye on it and you're, you know, playing it by ear. But I'm reading and I'm hearing down the road. So it's not today, not tomorrow. You don't have a date. Is it like the reservoir where you plan, you know, a tremendous program, dig out the quarry, and, you know, 10 years down the road, you replace the quarry with the water and so on? I mean, is it kind of like your capital program over 50 years to replace our pipes?
Well, typically with an asset management program, rather than coming in and just doing a wholesale replacement of everything, we'll continue to monitor what the conditions of the pipes are and only spend money to replace the pipes that are determined that need replaced at the time they need to be replaced. And one of the programs that we recently just put in that's really going to help us with that is a new program called AMI. It's automated metering infrastructure. We have the ability now to read every water meter in our system in real time. And one of the things that's been really allowed us to do is to actually start to look for places where we see abnormal water usage, maybe an indication that there's a leak in the system. And that's one of the great indicators for us to start then going ahead, if we see something like that occurring, to start looking further into that system, maybe perhaps bringing leak detection specialists out to look for those things. So it's going to be programs like that that are going to be in place that are going to give us an understanding of really when the useful life of some of these assets has expired and it's time to go in and to replace them. But I don't think we would ever anticipate going out and trying to take pipes out prematurely if they're still working. So
thank you for the answer. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, colleague.
Any further questions? Supervisor Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And thank you all for the presentation this morning. This is very informative, and this map is a great tool. One of the things I want to ask you about, I think it was at the same meeting about a year ago, discussed some issues to do with the rates and the possibility of looking at folding all of the rates in under the central system. And I believe this committee voted to have you all go back and update a seminar, or what did you call, workshop that you had done in July of 2011, that basically one of your proposals for rates was, there was three different proposals, but one of them included folding all of the rates in under the central system. I think at that time the number was 3 cents. It would increase the water and 12 or 14 cents on the sewer side, because the number of people in the communal systems was then like 800 versus 70-some thousand. And so I was just wondering if you'd made any progress on getting us an update on that possibility and what those numbers would be to do that today.
Well, yeah, and that topic has come up at a couple of these meetings, and basically the answer is still the same. In terms of the Loudoun Water Board has made a decision on this and reaffirmed it in recent rate conversations, that using the County Board of Supervisors policy that's in place, that had talked about that when the particularly the developer initiated, these communal systems were established, that they would be financially self-sustaining. And I recognize and I acknowledge that And we've talked about here at this committee that over time, at one point, was each individual system on its own versus now they're together in a group. And there was some decisions that were made based on that, and that was for the benefit of the customers to group them together, that it would be helpful. But I would say that what you're talking about with the rates and that policy is something that is a question that should be directed to our board, and our board has affirmed, and the answer to that is if the Board of Supervisors sees that issue as a very important issue that overwhelmingly majority of the board feels is important, that a change in the land use in the policies of the Board of Supervisors would be a representation as a guide to our board that's something that they should really look at. So I'm just carrying that message back, and I really have no other answer for that, because that's not a staff-related issue, and that is that if it is important for the Board of Supervisors as a body that be reconsidered, that a change in your policy would help get that initiated.
Well, I think we're getting the cart before the horse, because we really can't look at adjustments to the policy if that's appropriate until we know what the cost is. And that's what this question is about, is if you did that 2 years ago, I don't know why you can't do it now. Make an analysis of what the costs would be involved to folding them into the central system. With regards to the policy was initially that they were to apply to each system individually. You all reinterpreted the policy to apply to all of the systems. We have an opinion, informal, from our zoning staff that the policy doesn't restrict you from folding those into the system, but that's really an issue that's later down the road when we look at the at that, if it's possible or feasible. The issue that you need to look at first, or at least I need to look at first, is the affordability of it. Is it possible to do it? And I think earlier in your presentation, you talked about looking to the future. All of the jurisdictions around us that have had similar systems in place have folded them all into the central system because of the inherent problems that they have, and to diffuse the potential costs of them, you know, across. That's why you have a central system, is so that you diffuse the costs and bring down the liability. So if we're looking to the future, it's going to happen. It's just a question of when it's going to happen. So it might be nice to know what it's going to cost.
I'm assuming you don't have a calculator on you, so I would think it'd probably be best if we let the Loudonwater folks see if they can go back and sharpen their pencils when they have a free moment and see if they can try and run some more numbers.
No, and that's all I'm asking. Okay. And that's, I think, what we asked for a while ago.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, and then
Supervisor Clark. Well, I just, with all due respect to Mr. Higgins, there is no assumption that this will happen on down in the future. Quite frankly, these are two different systems. And I think that if this were to come to the board, that it would be a very interesting discussion before the board. Unfortunately, whether right or wrong, the policy is what it is. Let me ask Mark, because I just simply don't have any idea on this. When a home is constructed on a communal system, what is the hookup fee for that home versus a typical residential unit on the central system?
It is a different setup, and essentially for the communal systems there isn't a hookup fee.
Is it on the central system for a residential unit?
How much is it on the central system?
About
14,000.
Okay. Right there, and then so, I think what is very instructive for us through this whole enlightenment for the last 15 years is the fact is that we're better off not having any community that is serviced on communal systems because of the problems. And I think if I understood right, you all are looking at ways to try to at least for those that are close to the central system, to be able to pipe them as to resolve that part of the issue. And I wholeheartedly support where that can be done. But I think if there is interest by the board in having LCSA look into this issue, then the board needs to express it, not by one member, but corporately by the full board.
With your indulgence, Mr. Higgins.
Yes. Certainly. Go ahead. Go ahead, Mr. Higgins.
No, just to comment on those concerns, I think if you go back and look at the minutes, this committee did vote to ask Loudoun Water to just update that study that they presented to their own board as a funding option for their rates, and so that we could look at it in real time. And you know, the issue of tap fees, I mean, those are the kinds of things, if we looked at going forward with something like this, that you'd have to make that available or fair for those that didn't pay those fees. There's got to be some way to make it equitable. But right now, you know, there's potential for serious problems. And, I mean, if you look at Frederick County, Prince William County, Fairfax County, they've all had these systems and folded them into the central system because of those inherent problems. And I think we're going to be there one day. And so it might be nice to know where we're headed.
Well, I just one response. The committee doesn't have the ability to do that. Again, it comes from the corporate body. If the committee wants to go down that road, then it has to make a recommendation for the full body to vote.
I'll have to go back and look. Maybe we did.
Huh?
We did discuss at this committee and vote. Now, where?
No, I understand that. You can vote and make a if that occurred, it's a recommendation to the board.
Go back to the board. We'll have to look.
We would have to look. Supervisor Clark, thank you for your patience.
Absolutely. With respect to Supervisor Higgins' comments, of course, we have had quite lengthy discussions with respect to this item, and I support Supervisor Higgins' thought process on this. We've had a number of discussions with other representatives from other jurisdictions regarding what they've done successfully. I would support Supervisor Higgins and us bringing an item to the board directly, as the chairman Chairman York is mentioning, needs to be done in order for us to have a more in-depth discussion and for it to be addressed. I realize it's been discussed at this committee level, but I think we should go back and discuss that further. On a separate note, Mark, I see that you touched on the 600 zone water towers in this document. If you could just take a moment, because the 600 zone water towers are in the Blue Ridge District, and as you know, we've been working on that together for quite some time since you came forward to me last year and informed me on this. One of the things that has been surprising to the community is that there was no understanding or awareness that there would be any additional water towers. So there's still that question out there as to how Loudoun Water has gone about making that determination, where that information is in terms of why those water towers are needed, and if there would be any additional water towers after these two water towers. And then the last point on that is that it is my understanding that you only need to construct one of the two water towers in the foreseeable future, and that you just want to reserve that land for a possible second water tower, should it ever be needed.
There's a lot in there, and there's I'm hearing a little bit of a difference between some of the justification in our planning our system and how those have come about versus the upcoming process that we have. Do you want me to share a little bit on both of those? So that everybody's aware, in the basically, southwestern part of our central system, we have different pressure zones in our system, and so our elevated storage tanks that you see help serve those different pressure zones. As I mentioned in the overview, the land use policies of the county really dictate the extent of our system. Our responsibility then is to be sure that in a utility kind of a technical way, we serve that. There is, in our 600 zone, which is again in our southwestern part of the central service area, we're going to have the need to build these tanks. We started a process a number of years ago looking at land being available to locate these tanks, a site, and some land came available. We did some study and analysis to be sure hydraulically and from an elevation standpoint and from a cost feasibility standpoint that we could do that. There is a natural public process in place, and that is through the county's legislative process because that we need a special exception to be able to place that infrastructure. Prior to us beginning that application process on the site that we had under contract a few years ago, we wanted to share the information with the public to let them know about the process that was about to start and some early information on the on the tanks that were proposed. There, we received some feedback because of the proximity and geography of where those tanks are. They are visible from the rural policy area, which isn't served by these. We took that feedback, and we had enough flexibility and time in our schedule that we said, okay, we're gonna take that feedback. We're gonna relook at this. So as of today, a number of options were looked at. A new site became available through this process that we feel like, you know, came about because of the process that we went through. And we now have a new contract in place. We have an alternative site. And one of the primary, we actually are holding a community meeting in that area next week, Tuesday night. We're also preparing an application process to begin the public process through the Board of Supervisors here over the upcoming year. But one of the things that's very important about this is that while we hear the feedback, receive the feedback from folks who are talking about being able to see that tank, an alternative that is now going to be looked at has much of the same technical. There's only so many places we can go from a technical standpoint. And it's also, we were able to find something that, when we looked at the whole financial picture, actually ends up being a little bit better. And the cost for our customers is gonna be helped as well. So we really feel good about the alternative that we have. You're going to be seeing that application here over the next year. And so we'll be coming forward with that. As far as the information and whether that's surprising for people that was even a part of it, that is part of what I talked about earlier in terms of our facilities master planning. That is an ongoing process. And we've known for quite some time that ultimately we were going to have these tanks in this area. But, you know, until we get a better feel for we don't want to put those in too early. It's a following and kind of a timing sequence of when the growth really happens in that area. And so we're really trying to match that and follow that. And we have to be flexible when all the, you know, when the growth kind of slowed down and building wasn't happening, that put our timing on hold. Then all of a sudden that growth picks back up, the building is picking up, that accelerates our, so it's hard for us to just put out an absolute kind of schedule on what that looks like, but we're able to now. We're in that position. That's what the information is now.
And I do appreciate your thorough explanation and the involvement that you've had with the community. I know it's a long road because we still have a 90-day period and you're going to have additional community meetings, but could you address the second water tower concern and issue because it may or may not ever be needed?
Sure. when we do our master planning for this area, we make some general assumptions following the county's land use guidelines and the comprehensive plan as to what the density of growth will be out there and what the water needs will be out there. In that process, and right now we've master planned out to the year 2040, consistent with what the current projections are that are out there, it's estimated that the future water demands may require us to be somewhere around 1.5 to 2 million gallons worth of storage. It's a look in the future, so it's kind of an approximation at this point. As Mark mentioned, putting the tanks out there, the timing of that is kind of a balancing act. We don't want to get them out there too soon, because then we have to worry about there not being enough usage of the water, and then the water sits in the tanks and it gets stale and old, and that's an issue for us. We have certain Virginia Department of Health requirements we have to meet in order to do that. So that is why we plan to build a 1 million gallon tank and then set ourselves up for the addition of a second 1 million gallon tank should it become necessary. It's just something that we would continue to monitor. We would probably know the answer to that years in advance so that we could plan when that second tank would be added out there.
All right, and that confirms what I was saying. Can you put some sort of a timing, estimated timing on that, in that right now you're basing the single additional water tank that you're coming forward with the application to get that built on the land use, projected land use? When would you anticipate, best guess, a second one might ever be needed?
I think right now we have it plugged in somewhere between 2020 and 2025.
2020 and 2025, you may need the second one.
It's just going to depend on the rate of growth out in that area.
Well, I appreciate that's important, and I will stop the conversation at this point, but that was important information for me. Thank you.
Not at all. Thank you so much. Gentlemen, thank you so much for all of your time and the great presentation you gave this morning. We're deeply appreciative. You guys have a great weekend.
Thank you
very much.
All right. Our next item on the agenda is local fixed route and transit analysis, the final report. Come on forward. Thank you for the detailed report, and thank you for these large maps. We actually had some residents who came and actually have looked at them, so that was very helpful. So if you want to give us a quick update, and we can take action.
Good morning. In September, if you recall, Mike Lambert from Kimley Horn was here and provided a progress report on this study. The consultant team has worked closely with staff from the county and the town of Leesburg on this project on a really tight timeline. And Mike is back today along with Jim Baker to give you an overview of the final draft report.
Thank you. I remember to push the button. Thank you. The last time we were here, we were in the middle of the second task, and we'd done the majority of the work, but we have now completed all of the technical analysis and have drafted our initial drafts of the reports and are receiving your input and comments, among others. Those reports will be finalized in the very near future based on those kinds of inputs. The overall plan, this is a bit of a background. The overall planning that we undertook was guided by a number of principles and strategies. The top three on this page are ones that would be related to the efficiency of the system, and the second three are the ones that would be relating to the kind of service the system can provide its users. Basically, we wanted to make sure that the system, as it was replanned, would include service that would be accessible in all locations. That there were instances in the existing system where the buses were running on routes where there were roadways that are basically not accessible, like Battlefield would be one. Those kinds of things. We wanted to get the routes back into the neighborhoods wherever possible. We wanted to reduce the use of long loops, one-way loops in particular. They're an inconvenience, and they end up at the end of the day not providing as much coverage as they look like. And then we wanted to we identified the need to provide on-demand service in some areas where there's not been a sufficient response to justify local fixed route service, and where there is the prospect that more service will be needed in the future. So it's dual-fold. We want to provide on-demand where we can't get fixed-route service, and where we think that there may well need to be fixed-route service coming forward. In terms of the user experience, we then identified several strategies. One is that we want to have convenient transfers, and to do that, we recommended use of a pulse service so the buses would be scheduled to arrive at transit hubs at the same time. Buses would not leave until people had been able to complete their transfers. This is a convenience for the riders, particularly when there are longer headways. The time between the buses is longer. And then also, one of the things which we were pursued and were able to do was to extend the hours of service as a result of some of these measures. Starting with the existing system, as you can see, it's an extensive system where, and it does a good job of covering where there is development. The system which we have identified saves most of that system as it was, but provides several changes, one of which is the use of on-demand service as shown here in the shaded area. To provide service where it's been inadequate in the past in terms of ridership, or in some places we're actually providing service where there has not previously been such service. There have been a few route refinements, which we're happy to talk about at a later point in the time. In the case of Leesburg, this was perhaps where there was the clearest examples of some of those factors we talked about, the one-way loops and the service that would be enhanced by having dual direction service. The alternative, which we identified in coordination and consultation with Leesburg, as well as, of course, the Loudoun staff, provides access to the same major destinations, but it provides two-way service and it pulses through the center of Leesburg. One of the key measures, of course, is whether this would provide a higher level of ridership than the current system has been able to. And based on our analysis and projection, our report is that, yes, in fact, we feel in the next 6 years, beginning with the fiscal year of 2014 service, we can have a growth in Loudoun County of over 50% in ridership on the service, both for Leesburg and Loudoun County. How to proceed then? We examined some different models of how the county may best go forward in terms of securing new operations, and concluded that the existing experience with contracting for service for the commuter service was ideal. It shows the ability and the capability of developing a successful operation, and therefore we've recommended that Loudoun County and Leesburg remain grantees, that they seek funding to support the system, and that the county would then proceed with the procurement for a contract operator to provide that service, with provision also that the town of Leesburg would be able to ride on that contract so that the contracts are well coordinated and have single points of contact, those kind of things. In terms of other recommendations, we had a number, one of which, a key one, is that we feel that the current fare level at a dollar base level is appropriate, and that we also recommended that there be the addition of day and monthly passes. And the reason for that is that with the pulse service and the transit centers, there will be more transferring in some cases. If a person was to get a $2 day pass, during the day they would have spent $2 the same as they would today without the need to transfer. So it's an offset, it provides convenience. For discount, we believe that it would be desirable to institute discounts for seniors and mobility impaired persons during off peak. This is a fairly standard practice. We also believe that it's necessary to continue to seek proffers for transit infrastructure, including, of course, the hubs that we talked about, and then to continue to pursue funding sources with the state, of course, as also with the current fare policy, and then through a little more aggressive program of advertising. There is revenue to be obtained there, and then continued private participation in some routes, and to continue to promote that. Jim? Baker's done the analysis, the financial and ridership analysis. Jim, could you?
Sure. These next two slides present the estimated costs and the funding, where the funding could come from for this service plan. And it's presenting numbers for the next 5 years. For the costs, we've broken out the costs into four categories. The first is just the existing rural transit services that are provided in Loudoun County, which would remain unchanged. And then for the urbanized area, it's broken into three categories. One is the service that would be in the urbanized area of Loudoun County. And then within Leesburg, the Lees services funded by Leesburg, as well as the services that are currently funded in Leesburg by the county. So that first part of the table presents the costs. The second segment of the table presents projected revenues. And as Mike just noted, the revenues include fare box revenues, operations assistance from the state, private sector participation, as well as potential advertising revenues. And this next slide presents just subtracting the cost from the revenues as far as what sort of local funding is required, again, broken out by categories. If you kind of look at those last two rows there, the urbanized portion of Loudoun, as well as the county-funded service for Leesburg, in 2015, it totals up to around $3.2 million, increases to $4.4 million. And that's increasing partly because of inflation, but also because we are, over the course of the 5 years, assuming service improvements over those 5 years with additional weekend service and evening services. Right, there's also the operator costs, you know.
You'd probably need to do the hard copy.
Yeah, I could tell you the hard copy has.
Yes, the PowerPoint presentation is in the iPad. It was item number 3 in the attachment. Actually, it was 372, but who's counting?
A-123. Okay. And just one last note there, the cost, this is assuming a cost per hour for a contract operator. That's what the cost has been built upon there. And that, you know, would differ from the current cost today because, so that's reflected in here as well.
Okay, excellent. With that, I'd like to go ahead and make a motion because I know this has to go forward to the full board. So I move that the Transportation and Land Use Committee recommend that the Board of Supervisors endorse the proposed changes and recommendations of the local fixed route transit analysis and direct staff to include those elements to A, forward the local fixed route changes to the Virginia Department of Rail and Public Transportation as part of the annual TDP update. B, develop the fiscal year 15 proposed budget for local fixed route service. C, develop the fiscal year 15 state grant applications related to local fixed route service. And D, develop the procurement documents for a local fixed route transit provider for a minimum 3-year contract period beginning July 1st, 2014. It's been moved and properly seconded. Any discussion on the motion? Mr. Reed?
I have a lot of questions.
Shocks.
So I can't ask questions. We can only discuss the motion. Is that it? Okay.
Go hit it. Hit it.
Yeah.
Throttle up.
Yeah, I have some concerns. What is going to be the net cost to the town of Leesburg? Because you have all these numbers here and everything. The county's going to, like, for instance, in fiscal 15, it says $831,000, so I'm assuming that the town's going to have to pick up $700,000, or is going to be some state aid in this?
This is reflecting the estimated net cost for Leesburg, so $831,000 after state aid.
$831,000.
Yes, sir.
That is, I think, about a penny and a half on the tax rate in the town of Leesburg. Is the town going to continue doing all those routes?
Well, the assumption right now is that the plan that Mike presented there, that it's reflecting that service, which reflects 5 routes in the Leesburg area.
Yeah, we have 5 routes, and the projection that was done was taking the same relationship and funding and just carrying it forward.
Supervisor. So there's no state funding at all?
That assumes state funding.
Yes, this is the net cost after state funding.
After state funding.
It's important, I think.
So what you, wait, I have to say this. So what it means is if the state isn't nice to us, the number could be higher.
Yeah,
I think
funny.
It's important to note that on November 25th, the study will be presented for the first time to the town of Leesburg Town Council.
Mm-hmm. Well, the town officials are here today, I see. But what really kills me is that the town is going to put forward is that trolley service that's going to go to the village of Leesburg? Is that what they're going to do? Or is that just a regular bus that they're going to do to the village of Leesburg on that?
I think that's up to the town of Leesburg,
okay,
how they choose to serve that.
Well, why is it that in the packet it says that you can't stop the 7 to 7 to 7 on in the village of Leesburg, but yet the town can service it? Why? You said it's private
streets. The village of Leesburg is proposed to be a transit hub, and so there will be a lot of buses coming in there and doing the pulse, one of which would be a Leesburg route, whether it's served with a trolley or whether it's served
with
a bus.
But it says,
Mr. Reed,
yeah.
I'm just realizing we're a committee. If you have some specific questions, maybe it would be helpful to submit them to Nancy and her staff.
Well,
so that they could have those,
yeah,
for when this goes to the full board,
well, yeah,
for a vote.
It's just that I was concerned that you're saying, if we endorse this tonight, are we endorsing those routes?
Basically, yes.
Yeah,
it's the package.
That's the thing that concerns me. So, you see, what I would like to do is offer an amendment to stipulate that there will be a 7 to 7 to 7 route on the village of Leesburg property, and then they can cancel one of the other routes so the town doesn't have to pay for that with its trolley.
I would say that's probably not appropriate to do here because you're going to make a change and we have no idea what the cost or implementation costs are.
You're saying that,
I think that's something that Nancy and her staff can look at and have those numbers for us at the full board meeting.
Yeah,
and
I
the
really
board
would
can
like
make
that.
The decision at that time if they want to make that,
yeah,
change.
In their little response to the question that I had last time, they seemed to summarily dismiss it, saying it's going to mess up the existing routes. But if that's a transit hub, and you're saying the town thinks that they can put their buses there, I don't see why you can't. Your answer was that you can't do it because it's private streets, but yet it's a bus. So if there's no objection, I'd like them to look into, you know, canceling one of the other stops maybe and having a stop at the village of Leesburg instead, because it's much bigger than Lansdowne Town Center, for example. So I guess that there was no information on a bus for the work release prisoners. I didn't see that. That was a question that we asked last time. There's no state funding for anything like that to give them transport to their jobs, so they don't have to walk.
Not through the public transit,
okay,
sector.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'll submit some other questions, but I just have some concerns here that the town is going to be picking up a lot of this cost. I see that you're paying for a route on South King Street, which is wholly within town limits, but you're not picking up some of the other routes. So, you know, I'm just extremely concerned. I think that the town has to work with us to figure out what routes within the town are really not going to be viable, because this is a lot of money, $800,000 in the first year to the town's taxpayers, and I really want to. Get an idea from the town council and the town if they really want to go forward with that kind of expenditure, because I think they put forward a special of $350,000 this year, right? I think that's what they did just to close the gap.
Okay. Mr. Reed, thank you. Supervisor Clark, please.
Thank you so much. I have about 10 minutes I have to leave, so I appreciate you recognizing me, Madam Chairman. I want to thank Kimley Horn for this analysis. It's very helpful, and particularly staff, Nancy. You have such a challenge, so much work with respect to this project and the commuter buses and so on and so forth. Concern I have, and by the way, I support the motion, but because we are going to be developing an RFP and so on and so forth and going forward with modifications, but the concern I have is, of course, that the current service and what we're looking at only services a fraction of the county, a fraction, and that we have major densely populated areas in Loudoun that have no local fixed bus service. So My question relates to the development of the RFP, the timing for it. If you folks are reaching out to the Commuter Bus Advisory Board, recognizing that they address the commuter bus, but it is still all transit-oriented, and those folks represent the communities because we have appointees from each of the districts before putting this RFP out. I mean, it is almost, well, it's almost weekly that I receive emails and communications from my constituents about how poor our local bus transportation services are. So you have, if you look at the map that's on page 25, you can see that. I mean, there's none of South Riding served. There's none of Brambleton served. Those are two of our largest densely populated communities. So I would appeal to you folks to look at that, because I think it's a disservice to the citizens of this county to not be connected in. It makes it look as if Route 7 area is the only place to travel. So do we have a time frame on the RFP?
To have a contractor in place to begin operations in July, the RFP will need to be done in will need to be advertised in January.
Okay.
So
can you go to the commuter advisory board, say for their December meeting, and get some input?
They have seen the report. It was distributed to them, so they do have the report and the item, so we can do some follow-up discussion with them.
Great.
That would be wonderful. Yes, so you provided it as an information item to them, but I think soliciting their feedback would mean a lot to them and mm-hmm. would be helpful. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Nancy, specifically, in your shop, what is happening with Central Loudoun basically the Greenway South? There's nothing on the maps here, and I know she's concerned, Matt Letourneau's concerned, I'm concerned. It's the fastest growing area right now in the county.
Well, under this plan, it was intended to begin with on-demand service in that geographic area to kind of build a framework for what people want and need. It's on-demand service is often used to kind of develop fixed routes. It's the first step towards fixed routes. It shows you where
to see where the demand is.
The demand is and where the people want to go. So it gives you a little bit of knowledge before you lay a fixed route down, and it's a little less expensive to deliver if you don't have a real mass of people that want to go the same place.
Wonderful. Thank you. This was a lively discussion. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. That motion carries 4-1 with Supervisor Reed in the minority. Next item is an informational item, private eatery concessions to serve the Government Support Center site. Thank you so much. Come on forward. What's that? Some of the players change. You can give us, you gave a very in-depth report, just a brief report, and let's see if there's any interest in moving forward with this idea.
I'll make it quick. The board requested to know what steps would need to be taken to get concessions at the Government Support Center site, specifically Phil Boland Park, the Leesburg Park and Ride Lot, and then the rest of the Support Center site. Phil Boland Park, the area is zoned JLMA 20, and it's a special exception use to do concessions. Phil Boland Park has already been taken care of. The special exception for the park asked for concession uses, and they already have a contract at the park for concessions. So there are two locations we've identified where a concession stand or facility could be placed, one in proximity to the Leesburg Park and Ride Lot, one in proximity across the street from the emergency homeless shelter. Our concerns are it would require a special exception, obviously. We already have a special exception in process for the entire master plan of the property. It's been through first referral. We're about to go through second referral in a couple of weeks. So if the concession stands or areas wanted to be included in that, it could potentially delay what's already in process. Our concern is also there needs to be a little bit more study. We don't have enough information about what scope of services are required. what type of food are you looking to serve, the size of the facility, the types of operations that would need to be provided. We would need to know that in order to know how to size the facility, what terms, lease terms, things like that, what department would be operating and managing the contract if we went out to private sources. And then finally, there is a county policy regarding the use of county facilities. Any owned or leased facilities are supposed to be for the exclusive use of county operations. So concession service, there are some exceptions, parks, libraries, they're allowed to have some private concessions. So in this instance, we would need to amend that policy in order to do a concession facility at the support center. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Any questions for staff? Mr. Chairman?
Well, I think we're trying to overthink this. Every area I go where there's a few folks around on the street, you know, I guess I'll ask this. What's wrong with a roach coach? You park and ride lot. Somebody pulls up and is serving coffee and donuts or whatever. And the same with the parks. Why do we have to build a building that will sit and rot and that we'll have to redo in 20 years when somebody can pull up that can be licensed by the county? Doesn't have to be necessarily the sole vendor, but to have a license by the county to be able to sell to folks. I have no problem with buying from a portable vendor. I think I can get just the same kind of food that I can to a fixed facility. So. Just a thought.
And considering, well, we have a roach coach over at the Bluemont Nursery, so yeah, that has worked out fine there as well. Mr. Reed?
I think that's a great idea, Mr. Chairman. Do we have to change our policy on that, Dan? For a roach coach to be at, and they can be at different locations. You could have one up at the, you know, you could have one up near. Yeah, a portable vendor.
Why will they be upset?
Roach coach is what we called it at Rutgers. I don't know if that is a Rutgers term, but it's in the Wikipedia. Yes, Jan.
I don't want to say the wrong thing, so let me look into that and get back to you. I don't want to give you
misinformation. That'd be perfect.
Yes.
Yeah, if you could provide a written update of what the easiest, quickest way to have a
portable eatery. Mobile eatery.
Right. Mobile. And if there's interest, you know, the committee can talk with the chair and the vice chair about seeing if we can put an item on the board's agenda.
I think that's great. And I want to point out that Hamburg Durner right down the street started out as a mobile eatery. So thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, gentlemen. Next item on the agenda is the review of existing bicycle and pedestrian policies. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lou Moserak with the Department of Transportation and Capital Infrastructure, and I'm here today with Bill King of our department as well. We'll be reviewing the overview of bike and ped policies as directed by the board. Bill will be going forward, will be the point of contact for bike and ped issues within our department, given some recent staff changes and departures. Next slide, please. The policy documents outlining bicycle and pedestrian policies are really within two documents. One is our countywide transportation plan, last updated in 2010, and our bicycle and pedestrian master plan that was completed back in 2003. Chapter 4 of the CTP contains policy guidance within the plan, and Appendix 6 are the guidelines for specific facility types along CTP roads. With the update of the CTP in 2010, we incorporated the most salient features of the bike and ped plan into the CTP, given that the bike ped plan was developed after the previous CTP was implemented in or adopted in 2001. We've placed all of the bike ped policies in one chapter of the CTP and provides really for ease of use and a policy framework all in one place. Next slide, please. Within the 2010 CTP, the overall goal related to bike and pedestrian facilities is to build, or overall transportation goal is to build a multimodal transportation network, and that includes bike and ped facilities. There are 10 overall themes to the policies in the CTP in Chapter 4. Those are outlined in your item. The two overriding policies that are most pragmatic are the construction of bike ped facilities as part of all transportation projects, public projects, as well as developer-funded projects, and also to provide facilities as part of all land development applications. And that's regardless of whether or not there are existing facilities adjacent. We need to get the network built parcel by parcel. This is the way we have been consistently addressing these policies throughout the land development review process. Appendix 6, as I said, highlights or includes the guidelines for the types of facilities along specific roadways, and those were standardized with the 2010 CTP. For a two-lane road, we would call for sidewalks on either side. For a four-lane road, a sidewalk on one side and a shared-use path, multi-use trail on the other side. And for a six-lane road or greater, a shared-use path on both sides of the road. And within Appendix 6, there's also guidance for on-road bicycle lanes that are generally looked at when there's a specific demand identified for such facilities. Next, just a quick overview of the bike and ped plan. That was adopted, as I said, back in 2003. It was our first specific plan of that sort for the county and really refined the policies that were in the 2001 CTP and in the general plan as well. So it was our first step at addressing bicycle and pedestrian issues. Policies within that plan generally, again, as we have further implemented through the or further refined through the 2010 CTP, that roadways are to be multimodal facilities, that bike ped facilities are to be integrated with our transit service, and to really look at access to public facilities such as schools and parks. The bike ped plan is implemented through the construction of the recommended facilities in Appendix 6. I'll turn it over to Bill King for the remainder of the presentation and beginning with policy implementation.
Thank you. So bicycle and pedestrian facilities are constructed in the county primarily through VDOT and county transportation projects or by developers. Facilities that are located within the public right-of-way are maintained by VDOT. Facilities that are located outside of the right-of-way would be maintained by the property owner. These are typically HOAs or POAs. We have several mechanisms to implement the policies. The first I'll talk about is legislative land use application process. With this process, rezonings and special exceptions are reviewed by our department to ensure compliance with the policies. In addition, staff makes recommendations for proffers and off-site improvements located in the vicinity of the projects. During the by-right subdivision process, internal streets and frontage improvements are required as part of the by-right development. For highway and interchange projects, these are more straightforward. They are designed in accordance with the CTP as well as VDOT standards. Signals are constructed by either VDOT, the county, or developers. When signals are constructed, appropriate ramps and pedestrian signals are installed to ensure compliance with federal ADA guidelines. The final mechanism is board member initiatives, and these provide for a variety of different improvements. Standalone trail and sidewalk projects are typically retrofit missing link projects. Traffic calming projects, although aren't necessarily bike ped primarily, however, by slowing speeds on residential streets, you are improving the environment for bicyclists and pedestrians. We also help facilitate HOA projects. Typically, if a trail would be within the HOA right-of-way, then they would be responsible for maintaining that trail. And then finally, we also have done special studies for board member initiatives. These include developing priorities lists, analyzing missing links, and developing a GIS map of existing bike ped facilities in the county. So this is a sample project list which shows how the different mechanisms are used to improve the bike ped network in the county. The first two are sidewalk and trail, which are standalone missing link projects. The Old Ox Widening and the Pacific Boulevard Extension are highway projects. The following two, Concora Village Center rezoning and the Moorfield Station rezoning, are legislative land use application processes. The Tall Cedars Parkway and Poland Road signal is obviously a traffic signal, a county-initiated traffic signal. And the Route 7 and Belmont Ridge Road interchange is a county-funded interchange project.
Okay. And for the committee members, it's page 353 and page 354 in the iPad, the list.
There's a more extensive list in your packet. This was just a sample list. So the following slides show some examples of the various bike ped facilities located around the county. This first slide shows what a typical sidewalk or shared use path looks like. This slide is an example of mixed use centers and the sidewalks. You can see how the sidewalks are wider in this instance to accommodate a higher volume of pedestrians that would be associated with this type of facility. On the left, we have a developer-installed traffic signal, which was just recently turned on. It's important to note here that traffic signals are within the public right-of-way will be maintained by VDOT at some point when they accept into their system. But before that happens, they first have to meet all VDOT specifications and standards. So before the Loudoun County Parkway and Shellhorn Road traffic signal is accepted and maintained by VDOT, it will have to have a detectable warning strip, and the ADA ramp will have to be adjusted to meet the trail much better, as well as any other punch list items that may occur from the inspection. On the right is an example of a sidewalk on an interchange and what that looks like. And then this slide just shows some of the other facilities within the county. There are several underground pedestrian tunnels. This particular one is located on a golf course near an intersection, which can be used to remove conflicts at the intersection. And then on the right is our one bike lane that we currently have in the county. And it's important to note that although this is our only bike lane, there are other on-road facilities that are applicable around the county, such as a paved shoulder can be used as a bicycle facility, or a widened outside lane, if it's at least 14 feet, can be used as an appropriate bicycle facility. And so moving forward, you know, our staff will continue to implement the policies in the 2010 CTP and the bike ped plan. Also, with Metrorail coming, we are moving forward with our plans for that and gearing up. We will also continue to work with our partners such as VDOT and the development community. And as needed, with the next CTP update, we will update the policy documents.
Excellent. Have one follow-up thing for you. Technically, it's not in Loudoun County, but when the chairman had his Sterling-wide town hall meeting, a question had come up about having a connection on Algonquian Parkway in the eastern part of the county to the interchange at Route 7 where it becomes Fairfax County Parkway, because there is a separate bike trail on that side, so that there's a small missing link on the Fairfax County side of the line that would have good flow going back and forth, you know, away from not, you know, on one of the bike lanes on the street, but I'm saying a trail. Mm-hmm. That would probably be very helpful, and I'm looking at that as something important as well with the opening of the Wheelie station. Because, of course, you can take Fairfax County Parkway and hang the left on Wheelie, and you'd get right to the metro station. So there would be folks that would probably want to use that facility. I don't know if you all can add that to your list to poke your nose around with our neighbors from Fairfax on that.
Yes, ma'am, we'll certainly look into that. Might be worth noting that there was a priorities list that was voted on by the previous board, and that list we have addressed most, if not all of those. So a current priorities list could be created.
I know, but the difference is it's our priority, but it's in someone else's county. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you for bringing that up, Madam Chair. Let me ask, because this all came about as an initiative by Supervisor Clark, and I remember the board making requests. What I don't recall is what her initiative was. I think we turned it down to go for the information side.
Right. We were looking at informational items. She was looking at wanting to know how we were trying to retrofit, and you know, you'd have a piece of a project that had, say, a bike lane in it, you know, but then an existing community, you know, adjacent to it didn't, and that type of stuff, and how to kind of plan for that and prioritize the areas where these things needed to be done, similar to our missing link study for the roads. You know, there might be a missing link that would serve, you know, 50 houses, or there's the missing link that would serve, you know, 10,000 cars. Gee, we need to prioritize which missing link we do first. But this is an excellent presentation. What I will do is I will contact Supervisor Clark, let her look over that. If you could forward us the PowerPoint presentation as well, because we did not have that in our packet, to see if she wants to follow up with you all directly on any particular questions. Some of hers even dealt with some of the new walk zones that were going in with the some of the schools and some of the rural areas as well of, you know, how are these kids going to walk if there's no sidewalk, no trail, et cetera, that type of thing. All righty. Thank you, gentlemen. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Last item on our published agenda before we handle two items that were held over from our public hearing is update from the Water Resources Technical Advisory Committee. Needless to say, this is a quick item. Good morning, Linda. How are you all? Thank you for joining us. I'm going to get to the meat of the matter because I've had several members of the committee contact me directly. You all don't need to do a formal presentation because your report is thorough. I know there are four possibilities for funding sources that you all would like to go after to see if we can do more watershed management. Are you all confident, you know, that the funding mix, because I like the priorities that you did, you know, because we had asked you before to come back with a list of priorities, not here are the 800 projects we'd like to do, but if we could prioritize, you know, here's tier one, here's tier two. Do you feel confident that, you know, through state, federal grants and other things that you would be able to move forward with some good projects? Someone be brave.
Well, as you know, getting grants and that type of thing has become very difficult in the recent years. And that is why the former board asked us to look at some long-term and sustainable funding options. And that was the reason for incorporating this into the war tax work plan. At this time, from the information that we've been given, you know, we do not feel confident that grants, you know, would take care of the funding the overall program if adopted by the county.
Any other thoughts?
I guess I'd just like to say that we have been successful in the past with grants, but like Linda mentions, they're getting more and more competitive, and it's, you know, less likely that we'd be able to depend on those. And the types of programs and projects that have been laid out in this item require a long-term, reliable method of funding. And I think that's the issue of this, is what's available. The committee thought that it was probably worth the board's information as far as what is out there as possibilities, and then go from there as to whether the board would like to pursue those any further.
Okay. You want to chime in, sir?
I think what the WARTEC needs right now is to establish that work plan based upon the information that's provided in this item. We have two major grants going on right now. They haven't pulled those back, fortunately. One of them is almost $1 million, the other one isn't a grant. You all funded it. It was a project we got going on the Upper Broad Run watershed. We do need, and we've been considering this for years, a source of long-term funding.
Okay.
It's difficult. Mm-hmm. But it's tied to the watershed management, and that probably is the main priority that we need to be looking at, how we're going to do that over the long haul.
Okay. I'm going to take the leap of faith and think positive that we'll be able to find funding sources. So I move that the Transportation and Land Use Committee recommend to the Board of Supervisors that the Water Resources Technical Advisory Committee, with staff assistance, develop a general work plan recommending an approach for a detailed examination and assessment of costs and potential funding options for watershed management. It's moved and properly seconded. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, that motion will be approved 4-0-1 with Supervisor Clark absent for the vote. We'll take a 5-minute recess, then we will deal with the data center item that was held over from the public hearing, and immediately following that, the Cross Trails application that was held over from the public hearing on Wednesday night. Thank you. Good morning. All right. We're now going to talk about Zoning Ordinance Amendment 2013-0003, Data Center and Miscellaneous Commercial Industrial Amendments. I'd actually like a few other people to come up to the table. Mr. Reiser, I know you've dealt with this with economic development, needless to say. And in case we have any technical questions, if there's a data center provider here that does not have property next to existing residential, if somebody could come forward, be brave, in case we have any technical questions. I know there are a few of you out there. Is there a doctor in the house? Don't be shy.
I think they all have property next to residential.
Oh, okay. Yes. Just checking. I figured in case we had a technical question. The format for this discussion, I think, is going to be a little different. As I had explained, we did not think we would work all of this out today. It's more for the committee members to give you all questions that we can then have you all research and bring this back to the January TLUC meeting, because this is you know, changing the zoning basically across the county. It is not a specific land use application, so it's a little bit different. I will open it up for questions from other committee members, and then I'll add my own. Supervisor Williams, thank you for joining us this morning. I'll start with the chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll probably have other questions as others through the discussion. But first of all, has staff, Mr. Yud, where are you? The information I requested, do we have it for the committee meeting?
They're ready to present.
Okay, I would please go ahead and give it.
All right, thank you. Good morning, everyone. I am Amy Kresge with Building and Development, for those of you I have not met. We looked at where existing data centers are located as a first step toward this analysis. What we found is there are three parcels where the land is zoned for data center and located with data center that abuts zones that allow residential use. So three parcels where the land is physically touching.
Okay.
There are another eight parcels where there's an intervening street. Residential is across the street from the data center.
Okay.
So those four communities, the residential communities, are the residential portion of Loudoun Station, Cameron Chase, Ashby Ponds, and the Regency.
Okay.
So approximately 11 total currently with a residential impact. Whether you consider the intervening street to be how much of a factor, I know.
Yeah, well, it does add
that can
to
add
setback.
That can add to the separation between the uses.
Do you have that written out in terms to be able to supply the committee, or do you? I know it was kind of all at the last minute, or can you get it to us?
We can summarize that, yes, and provide a written statement.
Okay.
Regarding that,
and it would be helpful in that list to point out which ones have a data center already constructed near it, or one that is already perhaps in submission, and you know, and property that can potentially impact it.
Mm-hmm.
I asked Mr. Yud, I asked Mr. Reiser yesterday a question with respect to the siting of the equipment. And the question simply was, why don't we, in this ordinance, look at a siting of all the generating equipment and et cetera on another side of the building, as opposed to necessarily what we would call the rear of the building, impacting any potential user behind the building. And one of the problems I believe that we have is by the zoning ordinance, we are required that the frontage of the building be along the street, I guess, of what the address is. So my question is, could we, as a board, amend a zoning ordinance that gives the zoning administrator the ability to work with the applicant to adjust the building so as mechanical equipment can be located either on the side or a switching of the frontage of the building, so the mechanical equipment then is not necessarily located to the rear of a property adjoining a residential property. Is that a possibility that we can do?
I do think that is a possibility. I know that some of the data centers have preferred to put some of the equipment on the rooftop, and so that is another consideration, and sometimes it is preferable to put it on the rooftop.
Okay. Well, the question is to give the administrator the flexibility without having to go to the Board of Supervisors through a legislative process to be able to work with them to cite the equipment away, the noise-making equipment away. Again, and just my last question for right now is, again, commercial standards for in our zoning ordinance for noise, it was 60?
55 next to a residential district, 60 where it's commercial district.
Okay, so right now, as it stands, any data center or any other commercial use that abuts a residential property has to have it at 55.
It's abutting a residential district.
So the only difference in here is that the Planning Commission is recommending us to do preliminary tests before occupancy.
That, and in addition, the 55 decibel standard would apply if it's a residential use, not only a residential district. So in the mixed use setting, for example, the Loudoun Station setting, that would lower it from 60 to 55.
Oh, okay, so we're just basically then...
We're equalizing the residential use.
Right.
Instead of basing it off of the district.
It applies similar up to a mixed use development that has residential in it. Okay. I kind of would have thought that would have already been there in the zoning ordinance.
The specific language of the ordinance and the administrative practice has dictated otherwise.
I don't know if you're qualified to answer this or if this has been asked of the industry dealing with monitoring of noise. But I would be curious as to the accuracy of any kind of given test prior to the use actually being up and running, because noise is very fickle. It depends a whole lot on atmospheric conditions and et cetera. Was there any ask of any industry types, not the data center folks, and people specifically that deal with noise mitigation, noise studies, and et cetera?
Preliminarily, we have had conversations with a firm in Reston about the type of equipment and whether we would need to potentially upgrade the equipment from what we use now.
Okay, but I mean in terms of what I'm trying to get to is if we were to agree with the commission's recommendation, what I'm trying to look for is actually how accurate would that test be to the point of the real point of when this business is fully up and operating. My concern is that it would be a false test if that's the direction we're going on down. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, test or no test, they have to be at 55 up against a residential zone, correct?
Correct.
All right. And what is, and I'm sorry, Madam Chairman, just please. Working right into the question here. What does a citizen or an entity have to do if they are concerned that the noise that is being emitted from a neighboring use, how do they get that issue resolved?
I'm going to let Mr. Hambrick answer that. He's with zoning enforcement.
Good morning. As far as the citizens, whether or not if they want to try to figure out if this is an issue with the zoning ordinance, they do have the option to request that or file a written zoning complaint. Now, once zoning enforcement receives a written zoning complaint, just as with any other written complaint that we receive, we will go out to the property where the alleged violation is happening and make that initial inspection. Now, with data centers, now the noise from whether the chillers or the generator, whatever they may be, we do try to follow up or contact the complainant first to try to figure out when this noise is happening. If they give us a certain time, then that's when we will go out and we'll do an inspection and try to take a measurement, a noise measurement, with the equipment that we have. And it's just, it's a simple sound level meter that we use. Okay, it's nothing sophisticated. But this is what we use to identify whether or not there is a violation of the ordinance with regards to the noise at the property boundary. So that is the avenue that the citizens have through the county zoning enforcement to figure out whether or not there is an actual infraction with the noise.
So if they're, say it's deemed, it's 110 decibels, what happens next?
It's 110 decibels, let's say. Then we will contact the property owner and let them know that upon our initial inspection that the decibel level was exceeding that of the zoning ordinance, that was the noise level that's the maximum noise level. And then we will try to work with the property owner to remedy that. Now, there are many options that many ways that we can remedy that. I know in the past we have accepted a professional report or test from a certified sound engineer stating that the noise was within the confines of the zoning ordinance. Now, if they're not willing to do that, then the noise continues, then we will work with the property owner to try to for them to try to initiate some kind of noise attenuation, whether that be through buffers or whatever. So we work with the property owner to resolve that matter. And if we can't resolve it, then a notice of violation will be issued and we'll follow through that procedure.
Just one last question or request, and not certain which one of you, and maybe Mr. Reiser, your shop can work on this. It would help perhaps us as a committee to know in the industry. We can't be the only ones dealing with this, but maybe we are. What ways can we, without just large setbacks and berms and et cetera, what other ways are there to potentially mitigate the noise itself? I'm not recommending this, but like for some of our highways, we have the large walls to mitigate the noise sound and shoot it up as opposed to letting it go straight across over into neighboring property. So what kind of things can be done to potentially mitigate the noise impact that can be done at the time of development of the project? That would be helpful to me.
Excellent. I'm going down the line. Supervisor Higgins, any questions?
A couple of questions. Going back to the noise issue and a zoning violation, I mean, ultimately through that process, the person that is producing the noise that's over the limits is going to have to fix it, right?
That is correct, yes.
That was one. Now, I think these were mentioned the other night, but I wanted to go over this again. How many parcels are there that are involved in the county that would be affected by this?
potentially where you could locate a data center next to residential?
Right. No, in total.
I don't have the total parcel count of all the five districts. We did do an analysis of potential residential or commercial conflict, but I don't have the exact number of
parcels. Well, let's go back. There's basically three parcels that primarily would be affected that are residential by this, right?
Physically
next to.
And then eight that are across the street.
And that's an existing number. Right. I
wrote that down. I was looking at, wondering about those against the total, but I guess my concern is, and I mentioned earlier, I think that we can figure out how to accommodate those parcels without affecting everybody else and reach some middle ground. I don't think, for lack of a better term, I don't think we want to kill a fly with a shotgun. We want to figure out how to deal with that situation. Anyway, and I hope that that's the way we'll head on this.
I just want to note the number of parcels potentially, just based on a pure land use, zone to zone, the number goes up a fair amount from three, that we've identified as an existing condition. So, if you want to hear more about that analysis we've done, we have that for you, or we can include it in the written discussion about the existing.
Right. How many properties would enable?
The ones that are existing and operating aren't going to be subject to this amendment anyway,
just
on their.
Can I say this? Just to remind everybody, this is for us to give you all the questions, to do the research, to bring back to the January TLOC meeting. So whether it's a list, of here are 50 undeveloped parcels, and I would tell you to include PDGI, because that is an option that we could look at having this data centers in PDGI. So where is it that commercial land touches stuff zoned for residential? And don't just say residential, because residential uses could include a guy sitting in the middle of the Route 28 tax district with 300 acres, and the kids are waiting for grandpa to finally put the horse out to pasture and sell the land. Okay? So when I say residential uses, I want to know, is it PDH4 next to it, PDH3, R1, A3. There's still A3 here in the suburban policy area, which, needless to say, may not be, as Ms. Pastor would call it, the best and highest use of the property at, A3 in, say, the middle of the Route 28 tax district. So I wanted to reiterate that we didn't expect you all to have the answers to all the questions that we have in our heads. Okay, please.
I think she just said what I was trying to say.
Right. And we
I'm
have
curious
the parcel
in how
count.
Many how many parcels potentially could be affected by this ordinance versus how many are abutting residential areas.
I mean, the initial GIS query gives us a count of approximately 540 parcels. We've pared that down because we realize that most of those aren't going to be suitable locations for data centers. So based on the geographic location where we know they are most likely to locate based on infrastructure, we pared that down to a geographic area. I have a map for you where you can see that general location if you'd like to. Okay. It reduces the number to about 62 parcels. Again, we can do further analysis. We can look at what those adjoining zones are, as you mentioned, the PDH, the A3. Because, again, those small A3 parcels are probably not likely to have the residential when there's PDGI all around them. They're probably going to convert to industrial. So we can take another step of analysis. But the initial numbers are
right. But I'm using the perfect example is, let's go back to the guy with the 300 acres sitting in the middle of the Route 28 tax district. I, under no circumstances, because it's zoned A3, which is technically a residential use, would not want to go, and I'm sure Mr. Reiser would not want to have that discussion with a data center user, that for the guy who's got the 300-acre farm and the little rickety shack there, that they're going to need to put up, a 6-foot berm and, 200 feet worth of trees and this, that, and the other thing, and do noise testing for, one house in the middle of a 300-acre parcel. Okay. Any more questions, Mr. Higgins? Okay. Supervisor Delgadio.
Thank you. And I have time for the 504 parcels if you want to
you know, God has given me that time, so I don't mind having that ability to say I'm available if you needed me to be here for the 504 or for the 60 parcels. God gives me that time too. But the 11, that's nice because the chairman's got a schedule. So here's my question for the 11, and this is what the chairman asked and some of us asked at the public hearing. Have you had any problems with the 11 parcels zoning? This is zoning. Now, I don't want to get into the police stuff in a second. That's my follow-up, you know, the deputies and things.
With regard to complaints, Supervisor Delgado?
Yeah, we were asking about that at the public hearing. You weren't here, but all of us were. But you know what? We're dragging you into this now, so
very good.
Don't name names. Don't name names. Just give us a little taste of what's going on with your time when you go out on the field operations and you got to do your inspect the gadget stuff there with the hearing thing.
The total number that we have has been 4 complaints against data centers. That is correct. And that goes back to 2008.
Is it from one particular data center or from different ones?
It's been a few.
Okay.
Different ones, yes.
And so four complaints in all those years, and how did you handle it? How was it resolved? I mean, we'd like to know if there is a problem that we should be addressing, which is what we're doing this morning. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. The three that we have, I believe there's a fourth one that may be currently coming down to us. The three that we have processed, there have been no violations when we've gone out there to measure.
No violations.
That is correct. Now, there was one that, using our sound measurement tool, when we measured, the noise was above what was allowed. However, they submitted a test, an analysis, stating that these were the levels that were professionally measured, and they were under what was they were under the maximum, and so we accepted that as showing that there was no violation.
Madam Chair.
So you're saying that they had like a professional outside consultant come in, probably with larger fancy equipment, and do a formal test?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. That is correct.
Now, Madam Chairman, we know because we're in the urban area there, or the suburban area, the eastern part of the county, where there's a little bit of banging and noising and screaming and drinking. Now, do you go out on Saturday nights at the bars? You're not the guy that does that, but do you get referrals like that, you know, for residential, commercial? Those are deputies. Those are the sheriff department. Explain that.
That is correct. The zoning ordinance only deals with stationary noises. So that could be AC units, generators, anything that's stationary, okay? If loud parties or bands or equipment, you know, construction equipment, that falls under the codified ordinance, which is handled by the Sheriff's Department.
Well, that covers it for me.
Supervisor Williams.
Thank you, Chairman Baldwin. Thank you very much. And I want to thank you for taking this in such short notice. I know this issue is very important to the communities in my district, and I want to make sure we spend the appropriate time to research this and get it right. I also want to reiterate the comments from the Regency that they are ready to work with the committee as well as the data center industry to find a solution that works for everyone, and they've told me that time and time again. I share the concerns around noise and setbacks, and so that's where I'm hoping we focus. And we've submitted some questions to staff. And I know they're researching those questions. I want to address something that Supervisor Delgado, I get 4 complaints a week. The fact that there's been 4 complaints since 2009 is not representative of the community. And they can all shake their heads to that end. So there's a lot more. I think maybe it's a little bit unclear in terms of what the process is. And listening to what the mechanism is for a community member to go and get, there's no teeth. And it sounds as though we get to a process, there's a complaint, they do some testing, we work with the business. We work with the business. If the business is not in compliance, what's the penalty? It sounds as though there isn't really a penalty. This sounds as though there's some best efforts. There's some, hey, we're going to work with you. Please try to make it attenuate, I think was the word. that you used. But I guess one, let me get, if it's real briefly, Chairman, I'll just have a couple of prepared notes, and then I'd like to just make a suggestion. Three existing residential communities. It was Ashby Ponds, the Regency, what was the third? It was
Cameron Chase.
Right.
And so, I mean, Loudoun Station.
I think that there can be a significant win on this issue, as Supervisor Higgins said. And we don't necessarily need to, you know, hurt the data center community. That's the last thing anybody wants to do, is discourage them from continuing to invest in Loudoun. But can, in those three instances, can we draft the ZOEM such that in those, and just, and frankly, if there's future residential development next to a data center, I think that's, they should be aware of that. Just as though a community was going to develop by a road that was going to be widened, they should be aware of that, just like we did with the Metro Tax District. If there's additional residential, they should be, you know, caveat emptor. So I just really want to address the existing communities. And so can we carve it out such that those three residential communities and those, the land zoned around that is all this applies to? And the number I heard, you said 540, I've heard 100, I've heard 140. And I think that number maybe come from which sites may have the likelihood of developing of a data center at some point in the future. And right, there's probably a lot of land that could be, but it's not going to be really appropriate. So I guess one of the things I'm hoping is that we could make this really a very narrow exception to just really address the existing residential, which we've heard was only three. I got an email last night from James Gray, who testified on Wednesday, and he brought up an interesting point regarding the zoning's ordinance requirements under Section 4307 of the Zoning Code for open space on property and how a potential 200-foot buffer would impact that. Specifically, and this is a question for staff, and I'll get you electronically as well, can we research PDOP what the open space requirements are on the parcels that are adjacent to existing residential, and if the imposition of a 200-foot buffer would negatively impact total building square footage? And I think if we do that analysis, and I saw a presentation from Mr. Gray this morning, that part of that buffer would come from the Homeowners Association, and part of it would come, so it wouldn't necessarily push the entire data center property and limit their ability to have that footprint. And so we can get those materials to you as we kind of go through the process, to kind of demonstrate how they wouldn't lose any of their ability to develop the square footage that they would like. Another area I'd like to see some research on is with the noise testing. I understand what the Planning Commission has recommended might not even be technically possible, and from some of the folks that testified on Wednesday night. So that's, I think, something we need to – I've walked through the Regency. I know where these chillers are. And these buildings over the digital, which were really retrofitted to be data centers. The newer ones that I've seen, I think the technology and the buffering and the way that those chillers, the new ones, are built, I think that significantly lessens the noise output. So my feeling is it's really some of these kind of antiquated data centers that are the ones that are problematic. The new ones that I've seen, I think the technology has come a long way, and that the sound isn't that prevalent. Caleb just handed me an article from Vienna, and they're going through this same exact thing. There's a data center in Vienna that's been humming for 2 years. People at their end, there's state legislation getting involved. They're trying to mitigate it. This isn't to the chairman's point, to Buddy. Maybe we can just find out what's, you know, we don't want to discourage data centers, but this can't be a case of first impression in how people have been dealing with these data centers, you know, abutting residential communities. So maybe we can. One thing I'd like to hear back is what are the industry best practices around these noise emanating? And I will really wrap up, and I appreciate your indulgence, Chairman Volpe. Could there be some type of engineering certification in the equipment and design that will meet the ordinance? Can we get a chiller, for example, that has a standard that it will only emit X decibels? And, you know, is there a line of chillers out there that would maybe meet our needs? And what other mechanisms besides the certificate of occupancy could the county use to achieve the same assurance of compliance with the noise ordinance that is intended by the Planning Commission? And where I'm going with that is, if it's not possible to do the testing that we've requested through the planning, what is feasible? There should be some noise testing throughout the process as they're coming online and getting their certificate of occupancy. Can we do that without delaying their process? There must be some way that they can be good citizens, do the testing, and also do it in such a manner that they can go out and continue to have some certain timetables and move the process forward. I don't know if it's something you would consider, Chairman Volpe, but I would what was missing throughout the ZOAG process was there was no citizen input whatsoever. It was all industry. And obviously they were trying to do things that were in their best interest, but that piece of the puzzle was missed. I don't know if it's possible. I think Supervisor Reed mentioned this. What is it possible to have the ZOAG trying to work through these issues? I think the performance metrics, I think 95% of them can get taken out. All the ones that are burdensome can be taken out. And can we focus on the distance? And can we focus on the noise? And would it be possible to consider maybe having ZOAG reconvene to kind of work through this issue and have citizen input as part of that process? And thank you very much for letting me speak this morning.
No, not at all. Actually, it's something that I hadn't even thought of. Thank you for bringing it up, because at least we have lots of questions and everything like that. Is there anybody from ZOAG here? Do I dare ask if you all would be willing, you know, for us not even deal with this and for there to be a vote from the full board to send it back to ZOAG and staff can work with you all on all of these questions?
Colleen Gillis, no. I am a member of ZOAG, and we had a conversation about this on Wednesday morning about this. As you know, Lou Canonico was actually authorized by ZOAG to speak to you on Wednesday night, which he did, about many of the concerns that ZOAG had. We will be revisiting our work plan at our meeting in December, and I believe our meeting is December 11th, I think. I'm sure that we would be happy to discuss the possibility of bringing that together and setting a meeting, setting a committee together to work with the citizens and have a fuller conversation. But I'm unfortunately not authorized to speak on behalf of the entire ZOAG group. But there was a lively discussion and concerns about what happened after it left ZOAG. I think we would like the opportunity to revisit it with the board's indulgence.
Okay. Mr. Hemstreet?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out that the Planning Commission, this came to the board through the Planning Commission process, which is a public process that includes public work sessions as well as a public hearing process. What you could do is send it back to the Planning Commission, which would continue that process as an alternative to having the ZOAG look at it.
Mr. Chairman.
I just need to clarify something. Are you suggesting we cannot send it back to ZOAG without sending it to the Planning Commission? I think the intent is to ask ZOAG to sit down with the residents and have that discussion and then come back to the committee with their suggestions.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that
No, I'm just trying to understand what you said.
I mean, here's my bigger question. I understand it's a technical question, but in reality, this was initiated by the Board of Supervisors to do this. It's not a land use application. There isn't an applicant going, you have to give me an answer, you know, by November the 15th.
It is a legislative process, yeah. And in order to adopt an ordinance or make revisions to an ordinance, it needs to go through a Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors. The ZOAG is an advisory group that the board created to advise on recommendations for how to change the ordinance. And then in this case specifically, the ZOAG provided the recommendations to the county, and then it proceeds through the public review process. The ZOAG was invited to the Planning Commission during their review process, as was the public, but the public review process is with the Planning Commission. And that's how, and frankly, on this particular issue, it was through the Planning Commission that the citizens.
Okay, here's the thing, and I personally would have no problem if the committee wants to send us back and ask ZOAG to look at it along with the citizens and have that discussion, see if they can make recommendations to us. Where we'd have to go back to the commission is if we're making some different suggestions that have not been in the public process to be formally heard. Okay. Thank you.
So, Ms. Snow, I'm just assuming that if we were to ask you all to take another look at this, another bite at the apple, hopefully ZOAG would say, sure, we'll take another look at it.
I think that that's, I'm reading between the lines of the conversation on Wednesday morning, but I think that they would like that opportunity.
Okay, excellent. Mr. Reed.
I would just like to move that we bring an item to our next board meeting on December 4th, that we ask the ZOAG.
I don't think we need to, because we as a board have already sent it for the committee to work on. The committee is just asking for further information from the committee to come back.
Well, what I'd like to know is, should we set a deadline like February 1st or something like that? So that you're not in a rush. Okay, fine.
No,
yeah. I just don't think that we're going to have a problem here legally. I mean,
no.
The Planning Commission has made their recommendation. But it sounds to me like they would have to report, would they report to this committee and then to the fourth or to the full board, the ZOAG?
ZOAG would come to us.
Okay. And then we can basically ask the Planning Commission to go back and take a look at revising the ordinance.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. If there aren't substantive changes that weren't publicly advertised,
okay,
you know, we'd be fine.
Right. Well,
in other words, just for instance, let's say they all agreed to the fact that we need a 300-foot buffer. That would have to go back to be heard by the commission. Mm-hmm. If they come back and say, okay, everybody can live with a 100-foot buffer, the recommendation was 200-foot, does not need to go back to the commission.
Okay, and so if the ZOAG wanted to convene a task force, they could. They have the authority to have like a separate committee of the citizens or not, or do we have to have a FOIA mandate from the board. We don't have to do that. Okay.
No, it's already covered under their charter.
Well, that's very good. I, as you know, I suggested that during the public hearing, and I think that that's the best way to handle this. And in talking to Supervisor Williams, I think it's, you know, more narrow than a lot of us think. But I think he's correct that there's, I mean, he's getting complaints, and a lot of people don't necessarily complain to the county. They call their supervisor. So if he's getting four a week, I believe him. And I hope that you'll be able to work out something that'll be equitable to both sides. And I think we all agree with that.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
I will move that the Transportation Land Use Committee forward or request ZOAG and the citizens to get together to discuss these issues to see if there can be some resolution to the points and make the recommendation back to this committee. I hesitate to put a time limit on it, but I'll just say by March, if they can get it back to us sooner than that, that'd be great.
All right, it's been moved and properly seconded to have ZOAG put together a work group and try and work with some of the citizens. And I would like it to be the list of the 11 communities that are adjacent. Yeah.
The 11 parcels.
Yeah, right. That already have residential on them. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sure.
Discussion on the motion? Well, he went ahead and did that just so everybody would be copacetic. Mr. Delgadio.
Just wanted to congratulate the committee members on getting to this point. Good luck with the Gordian knot. I think you'll have a good time with the 11 communities, and I know that you'll be productive to the committee, and I know you'll be grateful for that extra work. Supervisor Williams, thank you for being on top of this and coming to the board with your hat in your hand and making it so that we can do this work. Thank you.
I know. Well, and just so you know, once he does his closing, I have my questions. So don't everybody run, okay? Mr. Chairman.
If you're going to ask further questions, then I just won't say anything more on the motion. I think it's pretty simple, but I do have some follow-up.
Motion carries 4-0-1 with Supervisor Clark absent for the vote. All right. For those of you who know me, I'm Irish and Italian. So Supervisor Higgins had this on Wednesday night. I'm more than happy to give it to someone. And I laughed. I'm like, no, you need to just come to my parents' house for Thanksgiving. Forget 55 decibels. That's why I said 110. Before this comes back to us, I want a noise expert. Because, believe it or not, a telephone dial tone is 80 decibels. A subway train 200 feet away is 95 decibels. Yes, which is coming soon. A whisper quiet in a library 6 feet away is 30 decibels. Normal conversation, which I guess I'm going to be on the higher end of that range, is 60 to 65 decibels.
What?
Okay.
What's
Del Gaudio? Well, he's full Italian, so he's got to be at least 10 decibels more than me. I mean, here's one that's really great. All right, you ready? Apparently, OSHA says the daily permissible noise level exposure 8 hours a day is up to 90 decibels. Okay? So I would really like an expert on this because I'm assuming, because we have a lovely gentleman who's very upset that the local high school has, you know, a public address system and has, you know, the marching band several nights a week. And we get lovely emails from him over and over again. But I want to very politely say to him, why did you buy your house across the street from a high school if you wanted to be in a quieter setting? But apparently he would prefer us to move the football games away from the high school so he can have his peace and quiet. Okay? You know, and I'm glad we already said, I said my trust but verify. I would like staff to work with Buddy because what you all may consider suitable parcels may be different in the industry. We've seen it before where several parcels have been combined for a project. And in reality, you haven't added the PDGI, so you need to re-look at that. I'd like a map, and I want that map coded so I know what's PDH4, what's PDH3, what's A3, what's TREC, you know, what's R1, R8, R24, and more importantly, what decisions have been made. Because, for example, Moorfield Station is totally undeveloped right now. But that's 600 acres of land. Trust me, I would rather somebody build a data center on that land than it sit vacant because we have a tax district that needs to start paying for itself. You know, at some point in time, these decisions are going to have to be made. And a 600-acre parcel, for example, could have data centers on one end of it and have residential on the other end. But are we going to end up having a conflict where somebody says, oh, no, you can't put data centers on Moorfield Station because it has residential? I mean, you know, some of the other things that were brought up, I want to expand on them, is dealing with noise and the noise expert, because I had a love of my father's an engineer, had a lovely conversation with him about this. He said, noise is like light. And atmospheric, whether it's a cloudy day, sunny day, the amount of humidity in the air, whether it's soft structures, hard structures, you name it, can all affect how noise travels. So when I say an expert. And to be honest, I think we need to look at some of our neighboring jurisdictions. There are several things that I know already that need to be struck out of this. Stormwater management is required with every property. So why this was added in like it's something special to a data center should have never been added in because everybody has to do stormwater management. And I think hopefully those are some things that can be discussed before we have our next meeting of this committee about it. For economic development, I would like to know how many existing data centers we have, how many employees those data centers employ, how much revenue is it to the county on an annual basis. I'd like to know what's already out there that's zoned but not built yet for data centers, and how much additional jobs and revenue that would be for the county. I'd also like to know, what are some of these incentives that some of our neighboring jurisdictions, including places like North Carolina, are starting to do to try and take the business from us? The other thing I'd like to know is how many of these data centers were new construction and how many of these data centers were put into an existing building? Because we had a recent application going into an existing building near Alban Tractor, where those poor folks had some problems getting their approval. I don't want us to put anything in our zoning ordinance that, for example, would create a problem for somebody who already has an existing data center, where they then become a non-conforming use. Easy example is, say, the 200-foot buffer. Well, that existing property didn't have 200 feet. And if it really needed a 200-foot buffer to Alban Tractor with their lovely tractors sitting out, that's a little absurd. So, anything else? Anybody else? Mr. Chairman, you want to close?
Thank you. I think we have to be a little cautious with respect to noise, and there have to be mindful that some of us could take 150 decibels of perhaps a nice, wonderful choir, but perhaps not a consistent 60 decibels of some of us talking to each other. So some noises, even at a low level, consistently can wear on you. And I don't mean to be flippant about it, but sometimes we've just got to be cautious about that as we look at trying to mitigate. What I'm really curious about when we come back as well, Cameron Chase, how much left can actually be built? That whole area across the street, it looks like it's pretty well about wrapped up in terms of the area that can be, that is left to be constructed on. The board has initiated, as a result of an initiative by Supervisor Williams with respect to looking at the Metro Tax District CPAM, partially to address one of the concerns that we've had that impacts Regency. So again, where we're going with that, I know that particular user of that property has been very flippant with the Regency neighborhood, using that issue kind of as a blackmail point in order for us to go forward to look at trying to put several thousand of units on the property. And I don't want that one particular issue to screw everything else up that we've been able to accomplish. And I'm just trying to, let's see, we have Loudoun Station. That center's been built out from the data use that is next door. And the other properties mentioned, I don't think there are data centers. There's data center potential property, but there's no data centers next to them, I believe. But it's not built. So my question is, again, is if we had the ability to give more flexibility to the administrator, the zoning administrator, or building and development, wherever it needs to be, to work on site plan to try to make sure we can shift the building irrespective of what the address of the street is, so that that mechanical equipment can be as far away as possible, I think would be a big help. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent. Well, I hope we've given you plenty of homework. Have a nice weekend. Our final item on the agenda this morning is the Cross Trail
No. We
yes,
already,
we did. We voted. On, yeah, 4-0-1 with Supervisor Clark absent.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. There's so much discussion I forgot. You've requested to have a noise expert come in. I think we need to take that to the December 4th board, but only because of the allocation of funds for that. So I'm going to ask the county administrator if he could just put an item. We'll put it in the administrative section.
All right, perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, last item on the agenda, Cross Trails. If we have representatives of the applicant, please come forward, as well as staff. Good morning. Thank you all very much for your patience. We had quite a full agenda this morning, as you can imagine. Don't be shy. We can always grab an extra chair. Okay. Since this is fresh in our memories, I don't think we need an extensive presentation from staff on where we're at, so to speak. What I'd like to do is go into questions of the issues, say, that came forward where there is not agreement between staff and the Planning Commission and the applicant, and just focus on what are the things that we need to work on. Okay. Mr. Higgins, this is in your district. Do you want to start with any questions that you might have?
I mean, I really don't have any questions to add beyond the comments I made the other night. I am concerned about the traffic in this area and mitigating that traffic with this project. I am generally supportive of the project, but for the past 2 years, I've been living the dream over there with the traffic congestion, and I don't see how this can't add to that, and I really think that that we need additional proffers or whatever to address that as the staff has recommended. Specifically what? I mean, maybe that's up for question, but I think those are necessary. And, you know, I don't know whose fault it is or how we got here. I just know that it's George Bush's fault. I just know that we are where we are, and I am concerned. I drive those roads every day when I come to and from Leesburg and going west, and so I'm very familiar with them. Anyway, that's all I have.
Can I just follow up, Chairman? With Mr. Higgins? At the public hearing, you talked about your concern for Evergreen Mills, and I guess my first question would go to staff. Is this regional destination or just simply a local retail, neighborhood retail?
This would be considered destination retail, big box.
Okay. This use is north of the Greenway, correct?
No.
East.
East of the Greenway.
Oh. Between Leesburg Executive.
I'm getting. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm just getting my. It is where I thought it was. I just got my north and my south and east. Okay. So what is our concern then with Evergreen?
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
No, I'm just asking staff.
Well, we had identified in the traffic study that there'd be a need for an additional westbound left turn lane, given the poor levels of service for that movement, as well as potential signal modifications and a receiving lane on southbound Evergreen Mills for that westbound left turn lane from Battlefield.
So on this drawing we're seeing on the screen now, the blue areas are points of concern that you all have, or what is this showing
okay.
me?
This is what I asked for. I want somebody to stand up, come around here, and point at exactly what we're looking, because that's the other thing that's important.
There you go. I see the
Thank
cursor.
You.
That helps.
Can you do the
I can do a little pointer.
Yeah, he's doing it with a pointer. Thank you.
There you go. Zeb Hoffman with Dewberry. The map on the screen before you is intended to represent in yellow the existing road infrastructure.
Okay.
The blue line work is current active Town Leesburg projects that are being constructed and will be active, will be available for, will be built in the next 18 to 24 months. Included in those are the widening and the extension of Battlefield Parkway from Evergreen Mill Road.
Okay, so we, the county, or VDOT is already paying to have that blue line done?
I believe that's a Town of Leesburg project.
Okay, Town of Leesburg. That's the other piece of this puzzle.
The other projects being Route 15, Vert's Corner improvements, and then other projects along Sicklin and Miller Drive on the eastern side of the property. The intersection of discussion is at Battlefield Parkway and Evergreen Mill Road.
Okay. And then my question for you, Mr. Higgins, because I heard the concerns. My question is, overall, are you in support of the concept, but have concerns with potential impacts that hopefully can get mitigated? Or so help me understand where you are with this.
As I said, I support the concept of what they want to do. Okay. I have concerns about the traffic flow. Part of what's missing on this map, if you head south on Evergreen Mills and the other road where that four is, it dribbles off blue, is Gleedsville. Between those two roads, as you head south, there's a number of neighborhoods and two very large neighborhoods beyond the bottom of this map. And those are a lot of the people that are going to be using this area and currently use this area and will be shopping at this place. And the only way they can get there is either up Evergreen Mill or up Gleedsville through Mason's Lane and or Battlefield Parkway, but they're not going to use Battlefield Parkway when they're coming from the south because it's much easier to hit Gleedsville, Mason's Lane, and then Battlefield Parkway and head over to Evergreen Mill. The traffic studies we got from the town of Leesburg that dealt with most of those intersections show, even with the improvements coming, that they are going to be inadequate in the very near future. So the improvements are good, but they're not enough, and this, I believe, has the potential to make things much more congested in the area.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, you done?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Reed.
I just want to add some information. Well, first I want to acknowledge in our audience today is Councilmember Katie Hamler, our town manager, John Wells, who's retiring. We wish John good luck, and Susan Berryhill, our director of planning for the town of Leesburg. The town plans no improvements to Evergreen Mill Road for the Battlefield project. I checked with the town engineers, and they said that they're not adding any additional turn lanes on Evergreen Mill itself as part of that project. They said that it'll slow down the project. And looking at the cross trail traffic study, the only thing that I have is this page that shows zero movements from Evergreen Mill going east on Battlefield, but you don't believe that either. You see that even though we're going to be paving Shreve Mill, which is going to offer an access point for people in the south, in order to access this shopping center, you have to take Battlefield Parkway. There's no way out on the southern side. They're not proposing to build Hauling Farm Boulevard all the way down to future Cross Trail Boulevard. So the traffic's going to go in and out of there in that one area, and even though they're doing some improvements there, I'm afraid we might have a Lowe's situation on our hands in Sterling, Madam Chairman. As you know, you have Lowe's in Sterling, and you have that other store, which is either a Super Walmart or a BJ's, mm-hmm. whatever, and you have, of course, Chick-fil-A, and trying to get out of that shopping center is just impossible. There's no other way out. And this, I think, is going to be a larger development. So I think that's where Mr. Higgins is concerned, is that the traffic study doesn't show any cars at all on Battlefield, and I just find that quite surprising, especially when the fact that we're going to be increasing. When you open Battlefield to Mead Drive, you're going to have more traffic on Battlefield Parkway. Therefore, more people will be using Evergreen Mill Road to avoid the Greenway, you know, to come up from jobs, and they're going to be coming to that intersection. Right now, it's a problem. You also have Heritage High School there and Freedom Park. So there's a lot of potential congestion there, and that's why Evergreen Mill, even though the town is going to do Battlefield, may need some additional lanes. It just may.
Question. If the applicant were to walk away today and go, well, you know what, you guys don't like this, so that's fine. How many thousands of retail, square feet of retail, are they able to build by right with the existing rezoning that they have?
They do not have an existing rezoning. They are mapped. You're not saying,
what they're approved to do, what they can do by right. How's that?
EIP. And so 10% of that can be, of the land area, can be retail. And we would argue supporting retail to the industrial or commercial development.
I understand.
But yes, 10% of the land area. So the total is about 400 acres.
So 40 acres.
So about that.
So how many square feet of retail would that be on 40 acres?
It's supposed to be supporting retail.
I just want square feet.
Off the top of my head, but it would.
All right. Does anybody have a calculator? 1 acre is 44,000 square feet. So 44,000.
400,000 square feet.
Okay. So they could do at least 400,000 square feet. So
a support of retail.
I understand.
So it would be spread out over the whole project. And
yes. And there isn't a huge road network that they're talking about doing with this project in the first place. I don't see on the paperwork that we were given that there's 15 different entrances to this property. You know, I'm just trying to figure out if we are indeed looking at this in a semi-logical fashion, or are we not thinking about the fact that if the applicant wanted to go forward with the existing by right, you know, PDIP does generate some traffic.
But they would have to build the roads to serve that level.
I understand that, but I'm saying in what they have to do by right, would they have to do a second westbound left turn lane on Battlefield Parkway at Evergreen Mills Road? Would they have to do a southbound receiving lane on Evergreen Mills Road from dual westbound left turn lanes at Battlefield Parkway? A new traffic signal at Battlefield Parkway and Evergreen Mills Road, and extend northbound dual left turn lanes on Sicklin Road at Battlefield Parkway?
Probably not.
Okay.
I mean, because the level of development would not be as intense as a destination retail shopping center.
Okay. Yeah, please.
You mentioned Sicklin Road just now, and that brought up. Are they proposing to do Sicklin Road as part of their improvements? Or is that just a potential cash proffer?
No, that's just a potential improvement that we identified.
Oh, you identified, yeah. You see, I think Evergreen Mill is more important because Sicklin already has a double left. They already have double left turns there. But in the revised proffer statement, I thought that they were looking at doing that Greenway ramp or a $1 million cash proffer.
That is incorrect. Their first draft proffer indicated a Greenway ramp or a $1 million proffer. Subsequent revisions to the proffers have removed the contribution, the monetary contribution.
Mr. Banzaff, can I ask why?
I'd really defer to our traffic engineer as to why, but the basis of it is there's the impact is not warranted by this job. The traffic study shows, and he can speak this whole lot better than I can, the level of impact of this project is not sufficient to require an off-site road improvement. And the ramp itself, the number of trips we have using that ramp are a fraction of what's required. So the ramp is going to serve as a regional facility for others to take trips off. Let me defer to the traffic engineer rather than have me wade into a subject that's not my forte.
Chris Tassinelli with Grove Slade. And I think Mike's comments aside, I think he did hit the nail on the head. I think the ramp we see as a regional facility, it's on the countywide transportation plan. We had to do an interchange justification report to get a break in the limited access line from VDOT to allow it. You only get that if it has a regional significance. So I think, yes, it's going to serve and benefit this project and this project's traffic, but it's also going to provide another avenue for regional traffic to get where it wants to be. And that benefit, I think we saw, was both had regional utility. Can I, since I have the mic, can I respond to a couple of questions that came up about Evergreen and Battlefield?
Sure.
So the percentage question, when we looked at our TIA, really what we were focused on was as the chairman pointed out, this project is on the east side, or some people say the greenway's east-west, so north side of the greenway. And we said, who is coming from the west? So we had about 13% of the traffic coming through that Battlefield Evergreen intersection. In our detailed study, we didn't have them coming up Evergreen, but we did have them at that intersection. So we did show the effect of site traffic coming through there. We could argue whether that should be shifted or whether more should be added. I'm not going to dispute that, but we did have some traffic. The one point I do want to make is there is an existing problem at that intersection in the AM peak, and it's predominantly due to the school traffic that comes in and out of that area.
There's a problem in the PM too, sir.
Well, if you look at the traffic studies that have been done, we don't show the level of service impacts and the detriment in the PM that we do in the AM.
Okay.
The question was asked about PDIP. PDIP uses on this site would generate considerably more AM traffic than the retail uses that are being proposed.
But is this Monday through Friday, or are you looking at weekends too?
We are looking at Monday through Friday because in this area, the weekend traffic of the background traffic is much less than the project traffic.
I mean, weekend traffic, my goodness gracious. So you didn't do any studies on the weekend? You didn't ask them to do any studies on weekend for a shopping center? I mean, do you know how bad it is to get to the outlets and to get to Kohl's in Leesburg and some, I mean, Lowe's in Sterling? So we have no data for weekends. When you have people down there in Red Cedar who have no stores, they have no amenities, you have people in my part of the town which will use this development, and I'd like to first say publicly that I support this development. I think it is a great development. We need these amenities in the southeast and southwest part of town. We have no stores. We have no shopping center like this. Oaklawn has done nothing. But there's no studies to show what the weekend traffic is going to be like?
When you look at total traffic at these intersections, both during the week and on the weekend, the total traffic is less on the weekend. Therefore, the critical time period to analyze has always been the morning and the evening.
Ms. Pastor, are you trying to say that there weren't, for shopping centers, we don't ask for weekend traffic studies?
Well, I mean, I concur with what Chris Tessinelli said. I mean, that came up in the discussions when we were scoping this traffic study. But given what Chris said, the overall levels of traffic that are currently on the roads are much less on the weekend. So when you combine it with this traffic.
Well, you know, Mr. Sherman, you know, Heritage High School has things on Saturdays sometimes. My synagogue does. You're going to have a potential.
They're booked to the max.
I mean, you're going to have Freedom Park has traffic on weekends, Saturdays all usually.
Mr. Reek, maybe I can help a little bit.
Yeah.
Over the experience, I would agree with them that they are correct with that. The challenge that I see from shopping centers, if you want to look at a critical time, is the period from Thanksgiving to Christmas. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about the rest of the year, the weekends are overall lighter in terms of trips because you're not dealing with the road network that folks are going to and from work.
Yeah, well, again, I think Mr. Higgins and I talked about this. The Greenway ramp, getting to that, you know, I have to ask the town, isn't the level of service at the Greenway ramp going on Battlefield working? And is the future projections working? I think it's working. The problem on the Greenway is getting to the west. I know you're saying it's going to take all these trips off, but I'd rather have the cash.
I think that's what I would rather have you build it. A critical intersection related to the Greenway is the Greenway ramp where it comes around and ties Miller Drive into Battlefield. And so by providing this ramp, people don't have to come to that intersection and take a left to head towards Sicklin. They can use this ramp. And rights are always better than lefts. I mean, that's the primary benefit of that
shopping
ramp.
Center traffic.
Okay, I want to ask a technical question. You said you would rather not have the ramp and just have a cash payment?
I would defer to Mr. Higgins, see what he says.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
That was originally what we had when the proffer was an either or. We would have gone with the or with
the cash, so that you could figure out where to prioritize, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, staff was
asking for both, but
I understand. Well, you guys will always ask for both, okay? Right. I don't mean to put the applicant, quote unquote, on the hot seat, but would you all be willing to go back to an either or, that either you hand us a check for $1 million? Look, let's not be dicey here, Mr. Reed, okay? Instead of you all constructing the ramp.
Madam Chairman, my name is Jeff Sachs with Kimley Horn. Our traffic studies show that our impact on the intersections at Evergreen, which is the one we're talking about,
right,
is de minimis. Our numbers are 4.5% of the total trips through that intersection when our project is developed. Only of the total trips, our project will generate 4.5%. And our studies show that that intersection would fail whether our project developed at all. That's that one. But mm-hmm. any of the other regional intersections along Battlefield, we're in the same situation. Our impact is minimal. We thought that the early provision of the ramp and Halling Farm and double lefts at Halling Farm and Battlefield is a win-win for both sides in that it provides access to our project. We're not denying that, but it allows plenty of capacity for background or others to get off the Greenway early at a point where there's often congestion in the evening and get onto Battlefield to go left or right. So that's a situation where we're providing a regional benefit that benefits both parties, whereas if we were just provided cash, it would not benefit our project at all. So that's why it's much more difficult for us to do that instead of the ramp.
Okay, well, we're just free thinking right now, Mr. Higgins.
I mean, frankly, going back to what the chairman said, I'd prefer to have both, but, you know, when you were talking about the difference, the change in the zoning, we're talking about the impact of all the retail being built at one time, potentially, whereas it would have been phased in building by building over time in a small percentage, and that's a big difference in the impact on the traffic. I say this with all due respect, but, you know, to me that ramp is like me building a house and proffering my driveway. It's feeding this project. And the traffic on the Greenway in the evening is heading west. It's not heading east. If I was going east, I could go east all the time. I just can't get home going east. You know, the other thing that we need to look at, that if you can bring that other map up you had a second ago, there's how many we got there? Seven ballparks in that area. We're building four more just down the road off that site to the west at Evergreen Mills Sports Park. And those things are jammed on the weekends. We just had complaints about a tournament that they had at the Evergreen Mills Sports Park 2 weeks ago and the traffic that it ginned up on Evergreen Mill Road and those intersections. The reality of it is that this area is underserved by the roads, and this project, while a good project, is going to add to that problem. And if we don't do anything about it now, we will be sorry later.
If I may.
I want to ask a technical question. I'm assuming most of the development that he's talking about down Evergreen Mill, that was all kind of by right housing developments. Is that what you're talking about?
No, Red Cedar and Cortland Rural are big neighborhoods that were big communities.
I understand. What zoning do they have? I'm trying to understand the...
They're communal system situations.
Granada.
These are neighborhoods with a lot of houses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look over there, you look at... Mm-hmm. The heck are we talking about? On the left there, 15.
I'm saying, is it 100 houses, 500 houses, 5,000 houses? That's what I'm trying to get a...
Each one might be 100 houses.
Okay.
Good manager.
Red Cedar's a lot more than 100 houses.
300.
Okay, so in that quadrant, as I'm looking at the map,
the
from Evergreen Mill that way, then you're looking probably, what, 500-600 houses?
It could be more than that going
okay.
all the way down.
There's a lot more than that.
That is good.
I know, but I'm assuming those folks that are further down don't cut through these neighborhoods to get to Evergreen Mill.
There are no
Mill.
Neighborhood There's ways no cut to cut through
the only
right,
way
okay.
to get out of there
out
is Evergreen,
onto Evergreen
Mill.
Evergreen Mills Road.
Okay, so it's more the ones from kind of here over that would use Evergreen.
But Madam
okay.
Chairman, a lot of people in my neighborhood in Tavistock, Kincaid, Forest, Beauregard are using Evergreen Mill to get in from jobs in Fairfax County, and it's becoming accident prone. If you remember, two twin kids, so 26 years old boy, men, lost their lives in an accident. We had a lot of accidents in Evergreen Mill. Mr. Higgins and I are talking about coming up with some funds to deal with that. But in terms of this east access from the Greenway, you also have Shreve Mill Road.
and we are paving that. We have this money now to pave it because we don't have money for Cross Trail Boulevard. And a lot of people right now don't get off at Battlefield because they get off at Shreveville and they take Sickle and up the road. So how many more exit ramps do we need going to the east? If anything, we need more capacity going west. Now, the climbing lane that we're building may handle that to some degree.
Yeah, but isn't there a ramp?
Yes, there is, but it's always congested. The problem is not
to
east.
Belmont Ridge Road every afternoon.
Yeah, and I take it I have to go that way now because Sicklin is closed, and you can always see that it's smooth sailing going east on the bypass and on Battlefield Parkway in the evening.
East.
Yeah, going east. So they want to build a ramp, which basically benefits their community, which is great. But you know, we have extra capacity going east already, which is Shreve Mill Road. I'd rather take the $1 million, but use it specifically on Evergreen Mill Road. If we want to make it specific for that intersection, we can do that. Or if there's something we can do on the Greenway to help their development, that's what I think we should do. We can't use it on Sicklin Road. I think that's too far.
Madam Chairman, I make a response to
that. Sure.
Just on the other side of the Greenway is rural. So there isn't any, there's no utilities over there, first of all. The two zoning cases you were talking about, Red Cedar and Cortland, were rural villages done some time ago. They provided their own infrastructure at that time, but there were no regional impacts from those at that time. That was years ago, that was then. There was on the county's master plan and on the town's master plan an extension of Cross Trail that went across the Greenway and over to 15. That would have helped measurably if it had been implemented then. It wasn't. It was taken off the plan. In fact, there were reservations through Granada and Rokeby and some others to provide for that link so it would go over to the road that goes to Hamilton. And I know Supervisor Reed was instrumental in trying to put that back on the plan, but it's not on the plan. So it's no surprise that there are traffic impacts out here because there's no east-west road to relieve those impacts. So what you have then is by-right development going north-south because that's what's available. And it's not been mentioned, but I've looked at the plan that the town has. There's a construction plan they have for Burt's Corner that you know about. That's one project, and that's funded. And also for extending King Street and widening it, which is great, and for elongating Battlefield over to King Street, which is also good. I've noticed in the last one on Battlefield, that's supposed to be a four-lane divided road, as I understand it, all the way across. They could and should, if they need to, build it for four lanes all the way across, which is what I think their plan is. I'm also told that they're going to stripe out the movement that would benefit Evergreen Mills Road because the town won't construct improvements in the county. Evergreen Mills goes up to it. It's a two-lane facility. It goes by the high school and so forth, intersects a four-lane road. That piece is in the county. Battlefield Parkway is in the town. The town is building a town improvement. The issue arises because of that contract could include those improvements. It does include a signal upgrade on the four listed projects in the staff report. Three of them are for that intersection. Three of those could be taken care of by the town's contract now. So it really would be something that ought to be done in that contract, just like Vert's should not be Supervisor Higgins' problem. It's a town project, but you're getting all the noise about it.
It's in the county, but the town's handling it, which makes it very interesting.
In any event, I mean, all those projects are needed, and we're not debating any of that. What we're saying in our traffic study shows is that the trips from our project do not materially impact those intersections. They're driven by existing needs. Otherwise, there wouldn't be in the town's project today.
Madam Chair.
Okay. I'd like to take a recess for a second. Since the town manager is here, I'd like you guys to get together with them right now and find out exactly what projects they are already working on, because I also don't want us to double do something if somebody is already working on a piece of this.
They're not.
We can speak to that.
Yeah, the improvements that we're requesting as part of this application are not involved in the town project, so these would be in addition to what the town is doing.
Okay, so these are not... Okay, I'm just making sure. Okay, I'm just making sure. When they said, "Oh yeah, the Wirtz Corner thing," I went, "Wait a minute. Let's hope we're not trying to build the same thing twice."
Madam Chair, if I may,
yeah.
There is also existing approved development within the town limits that would be adjoining Battlefield Parkway that is to be constructed. I believe that would be approximately 200 homes that are to be built there.
Oh, that's right.
And the retail center also further up near Route 15 and Evergreen Mills Road. So there will be potential for approved development.
Between Mason's Lane and the new Battlefield Parkway.
It's actually now the town did a text amendment in 2009, which I voted against. I don't like text amendments. 407 homes, and I think half of, are they all single family, Susan?
Single and detached.
Yeah. And they've dedicated the land for Battlefield, but the town is building Battlefield. That's right. There could be a potential retail center. So we have 400 homes on the Meadowbrook property, that big green field between South King and Evergreen and Masons. Yeah, Susan, it's mostly single family. How many townhouses?
I can't remember.
And I think the property just conveyed to Arcadia. That's right. So it conveyed to Arcadia, so they're going to potentially. Van Meter was actually looking to buy it, but they lost out.
To that issue, Cortland Rural is not built out yet. They're still building in there. I don't know how many homes are in there, but the density is every much as they have in Woodley across 15 there when you look at that larger map. It's a lot more than 100 homes, I can guarantee you. I've walked the neighborhood.
Supervisor Delgadio has been waiting very patiently. Please,
thank
sir.
You. Boy, this is a free-for-all between the committee members and the applicant and the staff. All right, I'll pull back from the microphone. Hey, at Lowe's, I just wanted to tell Ken Reed, you know, and anybody on the record, you know, I'm from that neighborhood, and I go in there a lot to go to Lowe's, you know, and there's a Sam's, and there's a Walmart. You got to go between the Walmart and the Sam's, and there's a giant hole. Watch out for the giant hole, okay? I've been trying to get the people to fix that, but it's not us. It's a private owner. But you avoid the giant hole. You go in the back of the gas station, and that's onto Woodland Road, which is now four lanes.
So there's another way out?
There's another way out.
That one way
you got to go the back way, and then Woodland is like a straight shot with no lights. Okay,
yeah.
Just wanted to let people know.
Simple point. You're using a completely different scenario to try to justify or unjustify one. There's no problem with the road network. What the problem is at our center in Sterling is the internal road network.
There you go.
That's right. And on the topic, Dulles has a capacity. It's the biggest shopping center in the area, so they have a CDA. I think this is a little smaller than Dulles. Would you agree, staff, that this is this operation? Huh? A little smaller than the Dulles Town Center. So they don't need a $70 million CDA for this, right? Just checking if that was looked at, because that's a big road network. And to the larger issue, which we've been discussing back and forth and pulling back and forth, the dips and the, you know, sure, the weekends, and as Chairman York said, Christmas, Thanksgiving, it's packed. Thousands of employees, let alone tens of thousands of customers a day. Costco has 50,000 people a day. I mean, if we're going to talk about volume here, we could be here all day. Mm-hmm. Volume is fantastic in the peak, and we're very happy officially. I don't think there's any supervisor or elected, if anybody here is not happy with the volume. We love the volume, okay, except when it's my voice. Now,
the Dulles Town Center Mall is about 1 million square feet, and this is going to be 550,000 square feet. So it's about half.
Half. Now, we're not recommending a CDA for them for road improvements for their internal structure, because they are basically going to pay for that structure themselves, as opposed to what we've done with Dulles Town Center, where they did this over a 20-year period, 15-year period. I'm asking staff. All the road improvements are internal.
I believe they would be building the roads as the development builds out. Mm-hmm. That's my understanding. They'd be
right.
Building
and there's
Holland
a, there's a whole network there. Now, I've been through that area a lot on the weekend. You got 500 acres with the landfill. You got 500 acres with Banshee Reeks. It's a rural area, as mentioned by the staff and by the attorney, Mr. Banzoff. I usually have two or three cars in front of me when I'm going to the trash, you know, going to the landfill. And I say, you know, I do that maybe a dozen times a year because I got six kids. And so, you know, sometimes it's a two-way street. I got to go there, and then I got to go up to Leesburg. So I say it's rural. I get rid of it, and then I go fill the car up in Leesburg. So I say it's very rural. I don't think it's, you know, I think the studies, if the studies are there, you know, usually as a supervisor, I sit there and I say, let me get the study, right? Now, if there is no necessity for the study, if I'm through there 100 times, you know, and I know the neighborhood, I've been on the board, I've been familiar with the land use pattern for that region as presented by Mr. Banzoff for the last 15 years. The chairman's been on the board for a long time. We know the land use pattern. If the town is sitting there making their improvements and it's all east-west and we bring in a retail establishment, I'm sitting in a very dense area in eastern Loudoun. The land use pattern is going to not be like that. So why would I want more out of the applicant for an area where there's no population predicted, no population planned? Why would I impose on the applicant a more intense, whatever it is, whatever we're looking for, when in eastern Loudoun we're not getting that for high density population?
I've been pretty quiet except trying to help direct. I'm going to say something. What's that? Sometimes it's 20/20 hindsight and it can bite you in the bum. I remember back in the 2001 to 2003 time frame when there were lots of changes being made to our comprehensive plan and our zoning ordinance. And I remember there was lots of discussion, and we've had discussions since then about the difference between rezonings and by right development. And most of the discussion that I'm hearing here today is that if the applicant were to walk away tomorrow and say, I'm just going to leave this a green field, the problems we're discussing are from the existing people who are already here.
I don't know that I agree with that, Madam Chairman.
No, but I'm hearing it right now. And this is one of the things that we were trying to look forward at, that supposedly we, the county, would take care of all the needs for any of the by right development that happened.
But,
and I'm a sick puppy, and I have, because back in the day you had to do a VHS tape, and I still have the tape from that final discussion.
You need to back out of this map to the other one that shows what's going on around there, because this doesn't represent it. This is too close. I mean, we have the whole town of Leesburg, for crying out loud. Look at all those developments, and that piece of land where the number one is, that's where they're going to build 400 more houses. The density that's off the map below Evergreen Mill.
I know, but those 400 houses have nothing to do with this applicant. Those 400, no, and what I'm saying is those 400 houses are coming whether this applicant does anything or not.
This application,
that's what I mean.
Chair, the existing, the 58.2 acres that are proposed for rezoning from PDIP to PDCCSC would generate 11,000 more trips over the existing industrial, light industrial, and office zoning
per day. And about 600 to 800 during the PM peak hour.
Okay.
Which is already immovable. And all these improvements that Leesburg is talking about doing to these intersections, at the end of the day, when they're finished, they're still going to be rated D, as in doesn't work, by VDOT.
Honey, most of the roads in my district are all D, and some of them are F.
Well, there, some of them will be Fs, too, if you want to see the study.
Yeah, at the peak. Oh, yeah. Fs. I'm tons of Fs. You know, you think everybody in my district had flunked elementary school. We're all Fs, you know, when it comes to traffic. Mr. Reed, and then I'd like to hear from you all, because hearing 11,000 trips a day, I'd like to hear some technical on that.
Yeah, I don't want to take away from the transportation discussion, but I do have a question about this new proffer language on public water and sanitary sewer. It says here that the interim and permanent public and municipal water supply and municipal sanitary sewer facilities shall be extended to the property, and then it says PDIP served property in accordance with town standards. I mean, what is, I mean, Mike, I thought that you were going to just put in the word interim for this pump, the sewer pump. This sounds like this is a permanent.
May I respond to that?
Yeah, sure.
There are three elements of the project. There's the part that's being zoned that you can see there. There's the area to the north that's in the town that's not being zoned. It's I-1. And then there's an area that's south of that, which is being zoned, that is also to be served by this pump station and force main. The area to the south, which we call the PDIP-served area, combined with the retail that's being proposed, as well as the I-1, would go to the north on an interim basis. And the reason for that is the town adopted in 2005 a pro rata for this project. And they, in their pro rata, they typically say, we, the town, will build the line to your property, and then when your project hooks up, when you have a building to build, you'll pay your proportionate share of the cost of that line. That's the way that works. Subsequent to that, at the beginning of this year, we found out that the town's budget did not include the cost to extend that line. So, and we asked them about that and said, gee, we can't develop this property without sewer. What's your plan for developing this southern line? And they said, well, we're doing the force main and the line for the jail and for the park. If you want to tie into that line, you have to build the government's piece of it. They want us to build their line, even though it's a public facility. We said, we really can't afford to do that and all the rest of this infrastructure. What if we went to the north and into the manhole that's available on the Greenway property, just on the other side of Battlefield? There is capacity in that line, which flows across and goes over to the bypass and comes in the plant that way. And our engineers and the town engineers agreed that that capacity was available for that service area. So what I described in the proffers was the area that can be served to the north, which it's more office, frankly, than retail. So it's about 687,000 square feet office.
But you see this new language in here, Mike, that I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have to ask the staff this. Does this tie the town's hands in the sense that this could be a permanent water and sewer solution, so they don't have to...
I'm not sure they've seen that language, frankly, because I just gave it back to the county. I didn't share it with them. But we call it, and it is, an interim situation.
What does our county staff say in terms of, does this preclude them having to pay anything towards pulling the pipe on their property to the lower Sicklin conveyance system? The other question I had is, can the town deny this and say, yes, you have to use the lower Sicklin conveyance system, tough luck?
I know that this was a discussion that the town council had with town staff Tuesday evening. I think if town staff were here to could discuss this or approach this directly.
I asked them already about this, and they said they're not prepared to say anything further than what the council voted on the other night. So, but do you read this language went through the county attorney, do you read this language to preclude anything, or can the town say no on the pump station, or what?
Again, what it says is, as agreed upon by the town, and their master plan does not support this to the north, that's what the letter to you says.
Right.
So what this ultimately says is, at such time as they build the pipe to the property, we'll use it.
Yeah, okay. So that doesn't preclude it. Okay, in your view, that doesn't preclude it.
The town would still have to agree to provide water and sewer to the property.
Right, and the town and water's not an issue, colleagues. I just want you to know it's really sewer. It's not water. Water, the town has no problem on the water hookup, which I think is to the north, but the sewer is the main concern. It does say interim, so it's really in the town's lap if they want to approve this concept. We'll have to deal with that at some future point in time. But I just wanted to ask those questions.
The only thing I'd add to that is that both the town and the county plan say the town will be the provider of the utilities to this project. It is the town JLMA. That's all the plans say. Thereafter, it's with us and the town to determine how it will be served.
Figure
that's
it out.
That's not a county issue.
The proffer would be acceptable to county staff. It needs to be served by public water and sewer. There are no provisions for pump and haul or communal system for this property, so the town would be the provider.
Okay, we're going to take a 5-minute recess since we've been here for quite a while, and I'm assuming folks might need to freshen up. So if we can reconvene at 12:15, and I would like us to come back with some resolution so that hopefully we can move this forward to the next board meeting. Okay, thank you.
sitting next to you again.
Good morning, folks. Thank you so much for your indulgence. Every once in a while, one of those little recesses can be helpful. I'd like to turn it over to Supervisor Higgins for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have a motion that would be to move this forward to the Board of Supervisors meeting in December with following changes or at least statements with regards to the transportation contributions. There would be the building of the ramp off of the Greenway. In addition to that, there would also be a $500,000 contribution towards regional roads, with $250,000 of that to be given at the first building permit, and then the remainder would become available at 250,000 square feet.
Second.
It's been moved and properly seconded to forward ZMAP 2012-0021, Special Exception 2012-0047, Special Exception 2012-0048, Special Exception 2012-0049, Minor Special Exception 2013-0008, and ZMOD 2013-0002, Cross Trail Commercial Center, to the December 4th Board of Supervisors business meeting with the inclusion of the ramp and a cash contribution of $250,000 due at the first building permit, and the second $250,000 due at the issuance of the building permit at 250,000 square feet. Any discussion on the motion?
Point of clarification.
Yes.
Is the motion just to send us forward with changes in the staff report and proffer statement, or is it a motion to send forward for approval with changes in the proffer statement?
For approval. You didn't say that. Okay. Any other discussion? Mr. Reed?
Yes, I just want to thank the applicant for doing this. Thank you so much. I think this is really great. I think people forget the history behind this project. I mean, the Peterson Company tried to develop this as a mixed-use development back in 2005, 6, 7. It really ran into a buzzsaw of opposition because of the residential near the airport. And then the county rezoned it to industrial. So we've come a long way here. This is a cash positive. This is cash positive to the county. Has no negative impact on the airport. The airport commission, I'd like to note for the records, is not against this project the way it was against the first cross trail rendition back in 2005 through 7. I think this part of town and folks in Mr. Higgins' district can use the amenities that you're going to be providing. We don't have a shopping center of any sort in this part of the area. We're going to get a gas station through Oak Lawn, hopefully within a year, but now we're going to have another one with this. I think they're going to have gas pumps here with one of these proposals. It's not exactly what the comprehensive plan called for, but it still is an improvement. The town is going to get its utility money, but I still think it would be far greater for the town to work with the applicant to try to deal with the lower Sicklin conveyance system. I still believe that you'll get better hookup fees in that regard. I would hope that the applicant will work with the town at some point to look at a boundary line adjustment to bring this into the town limits. The town would, your customers would benefit with lower utility rates, and the town would get its tax revenue. So I stand willing to sit down and work out something with the members of the council or the town staff with you on this. I know that there's some people on the council may not be happy with this decision, but I'm sure the mayor will be there for the ribbon cutting. Thank you.
Thank you. Closing comments, Mr. Higgins?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think that this will be a good project for the people in the area based on the fact, as Mr. Reed said, there is no access to shopping in that area, so this will be a good thing. And I also want to thank the Peterson Company for working with us to get to where we are. And nothing is perfect, but I think we made some great strides today, and this will be a good project.
Thanks to you,
Jerry. Yeah, thank you very much. With that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion will carry 4-0-1 with Supervisor Clark absent. Seeing no other items on our agenda, everyone have a great weekend. Thank you.